This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 25th of October, 2024. We'll be having, guess what, Halloween coming very soon. A couple of things about that tonight, not least of which, of course, is the Halloween budget by the Starmer Labour Party, genocide-supporting human rights lawyer running the country, apparently, right now. So we're streaming live from Eastone Studios in Bristol, one of several Templar ports in the Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is available free from APK Pure App Store and also the Apple App Store. Also maybe Aurora, but not Google Play, because the Google Play people, as a rather sneaky way of cutting out the small developers, they're starting to put the private contact details of them and their home addresses up online at Google Play. That's right, because they have to verify themselves, show their passport, their blood type, their biometric data and whatever. And they're now putting up people's nicks, particularly our developers' private home address, up on there. So he said, no, I'm not having that. Good. And we might see something in the news about that over the next few days or weeks. Anyway, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade zero trust agenda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators, hatchet jobs on the heroes, the McCarthyite witch hunts going up to anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against World War III and wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, climate, twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies crafted to make every crisis worse, and the politicians have nothing to say. Nothing to say. You see, BBC Question Time yesterday, virtually nothing. Anyway, a little bit, tiny little bit occasionally gets in there, usually from the audience nowadays. Lickland's behaviourist, techno-behaviourist, dark enlightenment puppets, cowards and control freaks see us as slaves to their little AI plans. Albert Pike's World War III curse relies on your blind obedience. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist WEF King Tampon Charlie and has been around the world, hasn't he? Didn't get too easy a time of it either. Vampire Queen Carmilla, they wage war on the British people together with China, Russia and the BRICS. That's how arrogant they are. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? Helping us navigate the accelerationist WEF's Fourth Reich matrix is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Martin, do you want to say something about the King's trip to Australia and Samoa this week? Because it hasn't gone down all that well, and there's this whole business of reparations. The Commonwealth, it seems now, is turning on its empire.
Well, obviously, he got heckled in the Australian Parliament, did he not, by an Indigenous senator, and he made some kind of half-hearted apology for slavery, although at the Samoa meeting. But of course, Keir Starmer ruled out any kind of financial compensation whatsoever, although of course he's very, very sorry for everything that happened, blah-de-blah. I mean, basically, don't forget that the Commonwealth, which used to be our empire, I mean, India, the biggest, most important country in our empire, is part of the BRICS now. They, you know, Modi was in Kazan, not in Samoa.
Yeah, so what with Mr. Starmer, does it make any sense? I mean, there was actually quite a reasonable discussion on Question Time I was hinting at just now last night, saying, well, how far do we go back? I mean, do we compensate every single country financially that Britain has ever been involved in? And what about, should the French compensate us for the Norman invasion?
Well, I think it's become an issue because all the Caribbean countries have got together with all the relevant African countries and they've put together, a demand about what they want to be done in reparations for slavery. I would argue that you can't really do much about anything in the past, but what you could do is stop doing it now. So, for example, we could forgive Third World debt. which of course, if we really want them to do anything about climate change, we've got to do that. And if we're not prepared to do that, we're not serious about climate change, but then we're not. And we're not serious about lots of things. What we really need to do is not go back and say, well, the empire was wicked and all the rest of it, which it was. That's why people are poorer in Jamaica and India than they are here. There's absolutely loads of evidence to show that that's what happened, that wealth was transferred from those countries to this country, and people are that much better off, and the people in those countries are that much worse off as a result of it.
No, but as you not, say, hang on a second, it's not necessarily true, is it?
It is.
No, it isn't. No, because the cost of living here is so... I mean, you can say somebody's got an income of X amount of dollars in Britain, and actually, that's not even paying the bills or the rent.
All right, I'm not talking about ordinary people. I'm talking about the wealth in the society, which includes the whole of the capital base of the country. Mm. You know, this is an issue...
Much of this money is sitting in some private equity firm or hedge fund there doing nothing, isn't it?
Yes, it's all... Actually, sitting in the Caribbean.
A guarantee against a loan or a guarantee against something. It's this money is sort of inactive in a way. It's almost like parasiting on the rest of society, trying to make more money from their various investments that they're making.
It's not inactive. It's used to speculate with, but it's used to speculate from... I mean, in the Caribbean islands, which are making these demands, and Barbados would be one of the ones that's doing it. They of course have got rid of King Charles, and they also got rid of Nelson's statue by you know, we don't want Nelson's statue, he can go in the museum, because of course he was in favour of slavery, Nelson, very famously. And
didn't the Irish get rid of
now the Irish got rid of their statue of Nelson in 1966 when the IRA blew it up, but that wasn't an agreed thing, they just did
it. It's a great song, actually. We played that, I think, the anniversary of it, maybe it was 2016 or something, where Nelson went up, not down. He went up first and then he came down. Anyway, let's have go over to Australia to have a listen to King Charles's reception that he got over in Australia.
The King has been heckled by an Australian ingrate politician as King Charles and Queen Camilla visited Parliament House in Canberra as part of a six-day tour of the country. Does this represent a genuine view of republicanism in Australia? Peter Tatchell is a human rights campaigner and director of the Peter Tatchell Foundation. Peter, thank you very much indeed for coming on. To what extent do you think Lydia Thorpe, the independent senator for Victoria, was right to heckle King Charles in this way?
Well, she is an Indigenous Australian, and she represents a community that has suffered great discrimination and disadvantage over centuries. So I think it was quite right for her to wait till King Charles had finished his address and then shout out what she did to draw attention to the fact that a genocide was committed against Indigenous Black Australians, and even to this day there is no treaty. Australia is unlike the United States and unlike New Zealand, which have treaties with their Indigenous populations. Australia has never had a treaty, and indeed over the years Indigenous Australians have been pushed out from the most fertile, productive coastal areas into deserts, remote deserts, and even then, when minerals and oil are found, they're pushed away again. They've been treated appallingly, and it's right that Lydia made a protest.
Is that the King's fault?
Well, Australia was seized in the name of the King, on the authority of the then monarch. The colonisation was supported by the British monarchy. The British monarchy sent its officials there to oversee the new colony. And in that new colony, dreadful things were done. Not only were Aboriginal Indigenous people dispossessed from their land and forced away, but, the English settlers, who had perhaps been indulging in fox hunting in England, there were no foxes in Australia, so they went what they called abba hunting. Mm. They went on horseback with guns to search out Aboriginal tribes and peoples and shoot them dead like foxes. And this was all done in the name of the British Crown. So of course the current monarchy has a responsibility to face up to that reality and to support Indigenous Australians in their quest for justice.
Well, it's an interesting bit of history, isn't it? I wonder if actually the Germans should pay reparations for World War II for taking over the whole of Europe. I mean, that didn't work very well in World War I, did it? The Treaty of Versailles destroyed the German economy, which led to the rise of Adolf Hitler. So I think they decided maybe that wasn't a good idea after World War II. But I suppose the main point here, Martin, is actually about land, isn't it? It was the land that the British Crown took off of the Aboriginals and the Indigenous people in New Zealand. In Australia?
Well, if we're just talking about Australia, yes, but of course the British Empire wasn't just Australia, was it? The question of reparations is always going to be a question, isn't it? People are going to say, hang on a minute, you owe us. That's what they're going to do. Well, and you may say, well, we don't want to pay you, but they're going to make the demand, aren't they?
I mean,
the Greeks gave voted to forgive all the money that the Germans were forgiven all of their debts in 1953.
I think what's so touchy about this, not only the land, is actually the international debt, isn't it? This sort of neo-colonial form.
Well, that's right. This is the
massive
point
amounts of debt that many of these countries have been forced into as a colonial policy to continue.
That's right.
After so-called independence.
That's right. In actual fact, the real problem is what's going on now. Obviously, so you can't bring people back. The people that died during the Middle Passage are never going to be resurrected. And no amount of compensation to anybody is going to bring them back. But on the other hand, why should Jamaica, for example, suffer under crushing international debt, which was imposed from the 1970s onwards by the City of London and the Americans and the Western financial elite? That is the issue. And if they want to do anything about, if they want any, they're going to make their demands, and then they're going to say, well, hang on a minute, if you're not going to pay us for compensation for reparations, then what about our current debts? What about something about that? And that's much more important, because, of course, that's the future.
Watch this space, I suppose. It's money and land. An empire, that's what it seems to be all about. But then there's also all sorts of other agendas in these wars taking place, particularly in the Ukraine, the Middle East. Do you think, start just on Ukraine right now, is that really about money, land? What's it about?
Well, I mean, all wars have multiple causes. The real cause here is the Western determination to ensnare the Russians in what they thought was going to be another Afghanistan, and has turned out to be not that at all. So the Russian economy has actually benefited enormously from sanctions, because they've actually cut all their ties with Western multinational companies. They've lost $300 billion worth of their national assets. But of course, if any of those national assets they're going to give some of them to the interest on some of it is going to be used to give to the Ukrainians right now. And the Russians are just going to seize equivalent Western assets inside Russia. And, of course, their economy is growing quite well. Ours isn't. There we go.
So what is that? Michael Hudson says, actually, this is a battle with two different systems. One is finance capitalism, which is where the people with the money control everything, including the media and the politicians, and industrial capitalism, which is where the certain amount of the economy, the infrastructure, is controlled and owned by the government. And so the people who are voting for a government basically to control the infrastructure of the country.
Yes, that's basically true. I think there's no sense in which the Russian leadership, even though it's right of centre in our terms, is going to, for example, privatise the oil industry or the arms industry. And that used to be mainstream conservative position in this country. I mean, they used to, Harold Macmillan was quite proud of having national industries. But of course, the current crop of conservatives don't believe in any of that. They believe in private things like the Thames Water, which is just being bailed out yet again, because in actual fact the system doesn't work. And if you carry on down that road, you're going to be in direct competition with countries like Russia and China and India and Iran, who don't believe in that, and they're right. So the super free market policy pursued in the West has actually undermined the basis of power in the West, and of course they're going to lose as a result of that.
This Halloween budget coming up next week, I don't know, it's not normally on a Halloween, is it?
Well, it's been messed around with. It used to be in the spring, didn't it? But then they changed it. It's, they keep...
I mean, surely the idea is to have a budget at this time of year, really, just before the Christmas break, really, because you have the budget and you have a debate about it, but it's actually implemented on the 1st of April next year.
Yes, I mean, I think they used to be traditionally spring budgets, but I think something happened and they changed it.
What happened?
Well, I think there was some. Someone
with a dark sense of humour.
No, it was Osborne changed it. I think for some reason or other, he said, "I'm not going to do a budget there. Because the budget was supposed to be about taxation, and there was another budget or another thing which was about spending. But I can't remember all the details, Tony. But they've moved it around. In a sense, it doesn't really matter when the budget is, does it? It's just the budget
when
it happens.
It's a bit of a laugh for the dark side when it's on Halloween, isn't it?
Well, you can say that, but I would just say it's a coincidence, Tony, but there you are.
Okay, well, it is probably, and well, who knows? It's funny because it was another coincidence with Halloween when Boris Johnson announced this big second lockdown, and he even did it at a weekend where the politicians don't normally do it. So maybe these people rather like Halloween and like to sort of have a bit of fun with the public and call people like me conspiracy, oh, silly conspiracy theorists. But actually, there is a dark side to this budget. I mean, what they're doing. Is they're changing the rules, aren't they? They're saying, well, actually, I'll tell you what, we want to be able to borrow more money, in debt the country more. What do you make of these changes that they're trying to bring in this time?
Well, what they're doing is they're changing the fiscal rules as laid down by the Tories when they were last in power last year. And what they did is said they were going to cut...
These rules have been going for many years. No, it wasn't just last year.
No, there's always been rules, Tony, but the actual rules get changed by the Chancellor. In actual fact, back in the day when I mentioned Harold Macmillan earlier, there were no rules. Harold Macmillan and his Chancellor could decide what they wanted to spend. They didn't have to justify it to anybody. And they brought in these fiscal rules. They brought them in because of the idea being that government shouldn't just be able to spend in order to get re-elected. And everybody bought into this, the idea of independent central banks, all of this stuff. So what Rachel Reeves could do, because in actual fact, constitutionally, the King in Parliament is the Constitution, she could just say, I'm going to rip the whole rule book up and I'm going to have a completely different rule book. What she's doing is she's trying to find wriggle room so that she can carry out needed public investment without upsetting the Office of Budget Responsibility, which you remember was set up by George Osborne, although Truss didn't bother to consult them at all about the Kwarteng budget, which is one of the reasons why it crashed and burned. So what she's trying to do is find wriggle room to invest, you know, basically to invest in the stuff that needs investing in. And Simon Wren-Lewis and other economists would say, well, if it's worth investing in, don't take any notice of the rules. The rules are stupid. If it's something worth doing, you should just get on and do it.
OK, so let's have a listen now to Faisal Islam's interview yesterday with Rachel Reeves, and as reported on the 6 o'clock news.
The Chancellor has told the BBC that the government will change the way it measures its debt in next week's budget in order to allow for more borrowing. Rachel Reeves said that debt would still fall as a share of the economy, but that the additional money, which may amount to tens of billions of pounds, would be used for long-term investment. The government's borrowing costs rose on global financial markets after her announcement. Our economics editor, Faisal Islam, spoke to the Chancellor in Washington, where she's attending a meeting of global finance ministers.
Here at the IMF, the Chancellor has decided the new set of constraints that will bind this government's hands not just for next week's budget, but also the next half decade. The most significant change is a loosening, in effect, of the target to have debt falling, with the conscious objective of reversing a planned decline in investment.
We will be changing the measure of debt. I'll set out the details of that to the House of Commons next week. But I've listened to the IMF, who have been clear that we do need to free up more money to invest in capital, to grow our economy and seize the huge opportunities there are in digital, in tech, in life sciences, in clean energy. But we'll only be able to do that if we change the way that we measure debt.
The wider measure of debt to be used is expected to include financial assets such as the student loan book and share stakes in companies, which could help with some planned green investments. The measure of debt, public sector net financial liabilities, which takes into account more assets such as the public sector pension scheme, as well as more liabilities, is forecast to fall faster than the currently used measure of net debt, excluding the Bank of England's balance sheet. This, in theory, allows for £50 billion more room for manoeuvre to borrow for investment. While not all of this will be used at the budget, the Chancellor clearly signalled to the BBC that she intended to reverse what she called the path of decline she inherited from the Conservatives, which would have seen a fall in government investment by £20 billion a year. At the same time, she will tighten up other aspects of the rules, having debt actually fall within this parliament and only borrowing money for investment. That means there will still be significant pressure for tax rises next week.
So, a bit more of that report to come, Martin, but the first thing I'd say is that actually these are not British rules. They've gone to the IMF to agree this.
No, the rules are British rules. They've discussed with the IMF.
Well, discussed with them. They've asked the IMF very nicely, haven't they? They're not over there for no reason.
No, the IMF is run by the Americans, okay? They basically run the
IMF. So they won't run the British economy, okay. Well, they do run the British
economy, but the point about the IMF at the moment is they are saying what you need to do is you need to increase public investment. That's what they're saying. So that would have been out of line. A Tory chancellor would be saying no, no, no. But the IMF, I mean, basically getting a thumbs up from the IMF means that the capital markets and so on will see that the IMF isn't going to
cause a Liz Truss moment.
Well, it isn't. But what she did is she didn't go to the Office of Budget Responsibility at all.
She didn't go to the Americans either.
Well, she didn't go to them. No, that's another reason why they were annoyed and why they dropped her in it. The other thing that she didn't do is she sacked Sir Tom Scholar, who was Chief Secretary of the Treasury, because she knew he wouldn't agree with what they were doing. So even though he was a top civil servant, the top civil servant in the civil service, the most experienced guy, she sacked him so that she could carry through. And, of course, the market saw that. Tom Scholar, we know who he is, the Scholar, yeah? Scholar by name, scholar by nature, he's got to go so that Liz Truss can have her own madcap budget. And, of course, that didn't go down too well and caused all kinds of problems. So she's trying to make sure that she doesn't scare the horses there.
The opposition said the government was fiddling the figures in order to tax and spend. But the Chancellor cited top economists, including a former Conservative Treasury Minister, and the words of the IMF Deputy Leader, Geeta Gopinath, to the BBC, backing the change.
Public investment is needed in the UK. If you compare the UK to other G7 countries, investment has fallen short. And so that spending will have to take place alongside having the kind of fiscal rule that stabilises debt over the next 5 years.
This confirmation sets up a budget of two distinct halves, Jekyll and Hyde, trick and treat. Tax rises to fund the end of austerity in day-to-day spending, and then more borrowing for strategic investments in growing the economy. If the investments credibly can be shown to help growth by dealing with bottlenecks in energy and transport, it should pass the market's test. But there is some nervousness about debt around the world right now.
The Shadow Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, said the change would result in interest rates remaining higher for longer, leading to increased costs for people with mortgages. Our political correspondent, Alex Forsyth, has been monitoring the reaction in Westminster.
Rachel Reeves isn't the first Chancellor to change the fiscal rules, and it's unlikely she'll be the last. But her decision to do so is set against the backdrop of her pre-election promise to run the economy with iron discipline. The Chancellor's case is that this is the right and responsible thing to do to get the economy growing, borrowing only to invest, not for day-to-day spending, and with oversight, all efforts to maintain credibility with the markets as well as the public. It will have been a carefully considered move, finally confirmed after weeks of speculation, but it will become a point of political attack from opponents, with the Conservatives quick out of the blocks to accuse the Chancellor of broken promises and fiddling the figures. Beyond that, this decision is notable for another reason. This is the Labour government making the case for borrowing, albeit cautiously, something that up until now, plenty in the party have been nervous about.
So that's the BBC speaking out of two sides of their mouth. They're saying they're trying to encourage borrowing, but then they're also saying, well, interest rates are going to stay up, and that means that those who've borrowed to try and buy their homes are going to have to pay far more. A drop in interest rates means that people will be paying much less on a mortgage, but if they can keep it up, that means people are going to have to pay more on those. But this isn't encouraging people to buy homes. In fact, one of the things that has been leaked about next week's Halloween budget, and by the way, folks, never mind Halloween budgets, we'll be having something very, I think, fascinating on Halloween right at the very end of the programme this week, is to try and take people's homes off them, to stop them passing on homes to their children. So people who've saved all their lives will find that there's so much inheritance tax on their homes, many people, that they just simply can't pass those homes on, Martin.
Well, I think what you said about the BBC speaking out of two sides of their mouth, they were reporting what Jeremy Hunt said who is the Conservative shadow chancellor.
The last report wasn't just reporting what Hunt said. No, she was just giving a
summary.
It's
not even clear that
she's
interest rates
what she was saying was
up.
That this. Yeah, well, okay, so that's what Hunt said, yeah?
Yes, that's what Hunt said.
So you don't think it will?
I think it's unlikely. I think what's going to happen is because we're
moving. Interest rate's going to come down to zero again, and is that going to help the economy? Look, I mean, this was a policy for a long time, which has sort of been ditched now, and ever since they started upping interest rates, things seem to have gone south fast. Loads of businesses collapsing, the energy price is going through the roof as well, and it seems to be a real squeeze on the economy at the moment, particularly with small and medium businesses.
Well, there's a lot in that, Tony, because you've ranged across the park there. I thought we were just talking about the fiscal rules, but you've read it about the whole economy.
That was about 5 minutes ago, or seven or eight minutes ago.
Yes, okay, well, that's right, but I'm trying to tell you, you know, as somebody with a degree in economics, what the issues are here, okay?
Mm.
It's unlikely that interest rates are going to go up because the world is moving into recession. In those circumstances, there's no real danger from inflation, even if you spend money. So it's likely that interest rates will stay down, and that's a symptom of the fact that the economy isn't working properly. The reason we had zero interest rates for all these years since 2008 is because, in actual fact, everything's bust. And that's why there is no real danger of interest rates. When interest rates go up, people can't buy houses. But the main thing problem is it crashes the economy. And that's the real danger we face. Not the Russian economy, Tony, or the Chinese economy, but the British economy, because it's been managed by the Conservatives for 14 years, who believe in a small state. They don't believe in borrowing to invest. They don't believe in higher taxes on wealthy people and all the rest of it. But ultimately, of course, we should have lots more social housing and council housing in this country, and perhaps more than half the population should be living in good social housing, not buying houses. Only the very wealthiest should buy houses, and they should only allow one each, because that's surely fair, isn't it, Tony? Only one each. Well, why should anybody have more than one house?
No, well,
that's the same in
Cute. You're living in a house with someone that has more than one house, and in fact, without somebody renting it to you. So what you're saying is that
I
person,
should be living in social housing, Tony.
You're diverting what I asked you then, actually. You're in a private rented place. I mean, surely if that your landlord is forced to sell that house, it's just going to go to the banks.
And I'll be out on the street, Tony.
No, but not necessarily. Not
where
necessarily.
Will I go?
They will be renting. They will be renting, but they'll be renting to somebody else, maybe to you, but it'll be owned by a bank rather than an individual.
No, it won't. What happened last time in 2008, my previous privately rented flat, eventually I was kicked out as everybody else was, because that's what happens. All the buy-to-lets.
So who owns that now, then?
It went to the banks, and then they sold it on to somebody else, and then they did the flat up, and other people live there now paying a lot more rent.
I'm no great fan of private rented. Of course, it's an absolute diabolical disaster, and I mean, we've got loads of examples of where landlords treat their tenants in an absolutely appalling fashion. But are the banks and financial institutions, if they take those houses, are going to be any better?
Well, if they take those houses, it's because there's been a crash, Tony, like there was last time in 2008. Loads of people got kicked out of their houses. In actual fact, it's only because I had personal connections that I managed to get anywhere to live at all. Otherwise, I might have had to go back and live with my parents. Now, the fact is that the economy isn't just the housing sector. This is the obsession of what happens
it's
in Britain.
No, hang on a minute, because it is actually quite important, housing.
It is important
it?
In yeah. Britain. It's
the thing
important.
Which most people spend most
I
of
know.
Their money on. That's why it's important, and that's ordinary people.
Yes,
that's
I
not
know.
Businesses or corporations.
No, but in actual fact, the housing bubbles that we have in this country, and that the whole economy is hooked on, is like being hooked on heroin. What we really need to be doing is investing in small and medium enterprises, but instead we're building conservatories. That's what we do.
So, what do you think Rachel Reeves is going to be doing with all this extra money she's got?
Well, it's not a huge amount. What she's going to do is invest it in public, public investment. Things like roads, bridges, you know, potholes.
Well, 50 billion is quite a lot, actually.
It's not in terms of the whole economy, Tony. It's marginal.
In infrastructure? No?
Yes, well, obviously it will make a difference. It's going in the right direction. We've had private affluence and public squalor in this country for decades.
I wonder if she'll be spending it on things like HS2 and Hinkley C.
Well, or possibly on a war with the Ukraine and Lebanon. Yeah, because wars are very expensive once you've started them. You think, well, it's only going to cost so much, but in actual fact, it might cost a hell of a lot more than that, mightn't it?
Just use your little crystal ball now, you know, Mystic Meg. Where do you think this money is likely to go? And is it going to be war or is it going to be infrastructure?
Well, she's going to say in the budget it's going to be on infrastructure, but if we go to war with Russia, it won't be on infrastructure, will it? Because we'll have to spend all the money on going to war with Russia if we're serious about it, which I think they foolishly seem to be. I mean, the fact is that all of these discussions we're having about what's going to happen with the British economy are all premised on the nothing is going to happen in the rest of the world while we talk about this, and that's just wrong.
I wonder if John McDonnell, if he was our Chancellor right now, would have had similar ideas. Who do you think is feeding Rachel Reeves these ideas and policies, and, you know, or is she really just an independent person doing what she thinks is best?
She is a Labour shadow, a Labour Chancellor rather than a Tory Chancellor, so she wants to invest in the public sector. The public sector has been falling apart for years. Schools have got loads of, you know, concrete that doesn't, you know, the building is going to fall on people and all this stuff. And that's because tax cuts were the be-all and end-all of Tory policy. They just want to have more money in the pockets of people who vote for them. Now, of course, they've lost the election. That's what the election was about. That's not what people want. They want investment in schools and hospitals. Now, how can we get investment in schools and hospitals in the circumstances? It's quite tricky. We could have a complete revolution and print money in a different way, completely reorganise the financial system, but that's not what the Labour Party was elected to do. They got 33% of the vote by promising incremental changes, and that's what she's doing.
A nice, gentle change. Yes, they'll be happy. The World Economic Forum will be quite happy with
this. Well, they will be quite happy with it because it's not actually going to challenge their fundamental interests at all. But on the other hand, they'd be even more happy with the Tories in charge because they would then be increasing taxes, lowering taxes on health, hedge funds and all the rest of it. Now, there is only a marginal difference between having a Labour Chancellor and a Tory Chancellor, but it is a difference. They are not going to be doing the same sort of sadistic public sector cuts that we would have had if the Tories had won the election.
But what about if Jeremy Corbyn hadn't been nobbled, as he most definitely was, and by the Israel lobby mainly, but also by some financial institutions here who seem to make quite a lot of money out of these various wars, and also, of course, are fueling the wars by, they are the finance capitalists. They want finance capitalism. They don't want Russian-style things to happen. So what do you think, you know, if there was some sort of an independent person around, a bit of an independent mind, like John McDonnell, what would you have expected him to have been able to do in this budget next week?
Well, John McDonnell has even, I think he's got an article in The Guardian yesterday or today, where he's saying, well, we must invest in the public sector. It's a total false economy not to invest in the public sector.
So that means
like
wages?
Wages, hospitals and schools, all of that stuff. Because it's the Tories basically want to shrink the state so that the private sector can do more. Because private sector healthcare companies donate to the Conservative Party. So if we can get more of them, then that's all good, isn't it? The privatised water utilities, they donate to the Conservative Party. That's what you want to do. You create a situation where you give the money to your mates, like all the COVID PPE scandal stuff, and then they give you money back so that you can get elected. And of course, the Labour Party, in theory, is supposed to be, the party of the workers, and is opposed to that. But in practice, there's only a limit. There's a limit to what they are prepared to do, or even what they can do, given the circumstances. So it'll be interesting to see what she does. She's got to please the people on her own side who want to see more spending on public things. And she's also got to keep the markets happy and the Tory press, of course, which the Labour Party is terrified of the Tory press because of the swing votes in the marginal constituencies and the first past the post. So they've got to keep those people happy. And of course, most people don't understand economics. I'll be honest with you, Tony. Most people think that the country is like a person. And if you get into too much debt, then you fall down. In actual fact, countries are not like that. And if you don't spend enough money into the economy, it starts to go down, which is what Osborne found out. They cut public expenditure, the economy got smaller, and the debt went up. So you can't cut the debt by cutting public expenditure, which is a basic principle that most people don't get, and the Tory press ain't going to tell them.
Money and your cost of living is quite a good way to make sure people behave themselves, isn't it? Because when they're in a fragile situation, they don't have the free time, they don't have the headspace in order to actually take political action of any sort.
Well, that's right.
And maybe they can go on a march once in a while.
Yes, well, I mean, but this has been going on for years. That I think the whole neoliberal paradigm is falling apart, but it's got a half-life like strontium 90. You know, everybody still thinks that ultimately you've got to be bringing down the level of the level of national debt. Now, it's a goal. You don't want to be getting too much into debt, but you don't want to be not doing things you should be doing just because you say you haven't got the money. You've got to decide what you want to do and then get the resources together to do it by borrowing or by taxing.
Now, in Kazan this week, there's been a very different way of looking at things, hasn't there?
Yes, I mean, obviously, it's been hardly reported in the mainstream press that this meeting has taken place. I've noticed, I've been reading about it, obviously, in the alternative media, but the mainstream in Britain has largely ignored it, even though most of the world is there talking about how can we get rid of the British and the Americans.
They're talking about that, because it's in Russia, they've been talking about it, much of the press, as Putin's meeting. Actually, it's not.
Well, it's in Russia because for this year only.
I mean, the people
Russia is in the chair of the BRICS organization.
People are very interested in what Putin's got to say, but it's actually not Putin's meeting. It's a heads of government from all around the world.
That's right. And next year it's going to be in Brazil.
This is eclipsing the post-war Bretton Woods institutions, and particularly IMF, isn't it?
Well, we're not there yet. I mean, obviously, some of those on the in the alternative media want to see this as, yes, this is a big game-changing moment. We're talking about dates being important. And Putin actually said this. We've had this meeting on October the 24th, because it was on October the 24th, 1948, that the United Nations was founded. So we've decided to have our meeting on October the 24th in Kazan, because this is a refounding of the United Nations. So that's why we chose that date. And he made it explicit that that's why the date had been chosen.
That's a bit arrogant, isn't it? How can they in fact, Guterres was there. What did I'd love to have seen his face when he told him that. We're actually taking over the United Nations or refounding you because you're so useless.
Yes,
in fact, we had a couple of weeks ago, or last week indeed, we had the Foreign Minister of Russia's Lavrov's speech saying how, and spelling out how much the United Nations has failed and how actually it was a pretty useless institution these days. But all we've got.
Well, but Guterres went to the meeting, and of course all the Western politicians are screaming that he shouldn't have gone. But I think he's originally a Spanish socialist, isn't he, Guterres? And he's saying, well, look, you know, all these countries are here. It'd be pretty weird if I wasn't here as a UN Secretary General. I need to find out what these people want, you know. I mean, I've got India. What's really interesting is that India and China have agreed to settle their territorial dispute. And Armenia and Azerbaijan had a meeting to try and sort their problems out. This is what the United Nations should be doing, but can't be doing because it's dominated by the US veto in the Security Council. And of course, everybody there was all opposed to what the Israelis are doing in Gaza and in Lebanon. But of course, that's why the Western countries weren't invited. In another world, Tony, we could all be in the same meeting with the British and the Americans in the room as well. But as things stand at the moment, that's just not on, is it?
Putin is calling this the New World Order.
He would do, wouldn't he? I mean, what's happening is that the developing countries, are basically ganging up on the Western countries, the imperialist countries, because they still use that kind of language. And we were talking earlier about international debt. Imperialism hasn't gone away. It's not something to apologise for that happened in the past. It's still going on. And that's the problem. And of course, ultimately, these things are settled on the battlefield as they are being settled on the battlefield.
Well, our correspondent at Kazan, at the BRICS conference, I spoke to earlier on today, is a certain John Shipton. Julian Assange's daddy was over there, so this is what he had to say to me earlier on.
My name is John Shipton. I'm Australian. At the moment, I'm in Switzerland, in Lugano, with the Bitcoin conference, having come yesterday from Kazan.
You haven't mentioned your connection with Julian. Can you give us a quick update?
I'm Julian Assange's father, and up until 4 months ago, was deeply involved in the campaign to free Julian from his incarceration by the United Kingdom and the United States.
And how is he?
He's back in Australia looking after the kids, and I think there's a movie where it was quite funny, where they said taking baby steps, his progressive and moving towards good health, goes to swims in the ocean, Stella says, and goes for what we call in Australia bush walks. I think you may know them as hiking, I think.
Lovely. Anyway, so where exactly is this conference you're at, the BRICS one, taking place?
It's in Lugano, which is the Italian speaking city on the border of Switzerland and Italy.
Right, so
the city has adopted Bitcoin, so it's a Bitcoin city. You can purchase or whatever you want to purchase. Really, you can purchase items with the use of Bitcoin, and there's a few Bitcoin ATMs around the place.
Okay, so what do you make of the whole sort of tension building up around the world at the moment? It's almost as if there's some sort of inevitable separation of the superpowers of Russia and China from the United States and their various allies.
I guess so. I mean, the point President Putin made in his speech was that they're not anti-Western, they're just non-Western. I guess the Western framing of conversation that, there's sort of only the Western and there's a bunch of others, they have taken it upon themselves to repair that, particularly as the West seems to be in a period of decline. Inert, I think, is the word that I would use.
Okay, what about economics around the world? Because, it's not just that the military aggression from the West seems to have increased, particularly in Gaza, well, in the Middle East generally, and obviously in Ukraine. But the economy seems to be going down the tubes, John.
Well, if we take the work of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange as a crew, the crooks, in 2010, 2011, the GDP of the engine of Europe, which is Germany, they increased by 3.5%. Last year, German GDP was an increase of 0.2. That is, they're going out backwards. The other thing is that there's the population increase among the foundational peoples of Europe in every country is below replenishment rate. And similarly, actually, it's curious, but similarly in Australia, the European descent people reproducing it at two children per mother, which is just below the replenishment rate. In the South Korea, it's 0.6 children per woman, so in 50 years, the population will halve. So that seems to be the phenomena in the West. Also, the centre of gravity of the world has moved eastward. So that geopolitics, finance, economies, and the populations, and the re-emergence of the great 5,000-year-old civilizations, China, India, Iran, and of course, the new civilization, recognized now as a civilization entity, is Russia. But this is, if you imagine, you have to use one imagination to grasp the how great this movement of consciousness, culture, economics, towards the demographic centre of the world, how important that is. It's profound.
Finally, what about Gaza? Because this is just going from bad to worse. We're now in the situation in northern Gaza where the Israelis are openly saying, well, we're just going to kill women and children. They've stopped for 3 weeks nearly now, I think it is, any aid getting in whatsoever, and hundreds of thousands of people there. And they're also, of course, bombing these refugee camps, just people in tents using the sort of munitions that the Americans have supplied them to attack military targets like bunkers.
Yes, you know, that's the tragedy. Are there enough words in enough capacities, English in prose, to describe that depravity? And such depravity that's been committed by the Israelis upon the Palestinians, so foul and vile. We turn our backs upon Israel and reject the very notion of that state. It has earned for itself the eternal obloquy in human life and human beings everywhere. So I cannot, in no way can I contemplate a future for that organization called Israel. It's moved itself far beyond the civilization requirements and the life requirements of people and human beings. Altogether, it's gone.
Okay, John Shipton, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So Martin, you were pointing out the German economy's actually been shrinking, but any other things to take from BRICS and from John's comments there?
Well, I mean, he's pointing out the obvious. I mean, obviously, because he comes from Australia, he's got more of a sense of the world at large than people in this country have, because they travel more than we do, you know, and they tend to look outwards to the rest of the world in a way that we don't.
And for example, China is rather nearby, so have to be a little bit more realistic.
Well, it's their main trading partner.
Yeah. You know,
that's what keeps them in beer money, is trading with the Chinese. So, I mean, obviously, I mean, Australia, in fact, should be, I mean, and of course, Paul Keating and Mike Rudd, who used to be the prime ministers in Australia, are saying this going out, kicking sand in the Chinese's eyes is absolutely idiotic from our point of view. We need to be making friends with the Chinese, we need to be working with them, because there's all sorts of business opportunities for us there. It's the future of our country to work with them. And instead, we're trying to make them mad with us, because we're allowing the Americans to plot a war against them from our territory. And of course, the BT bombers that bombed Yemen flew the other day from Darwin. And there's no reason for the Americans to fly those bombers from Darwin. They could have flown them from Diego Garcia, which is obviously British control, or then now the Americans have got it, you know. But they're trying to make sure that the Labour government in Australia has got its hands dirtied up, that they're involved, that they've been involved in helping Israel as well, and that they can't, that, you know, that therefore they can't make friends with the BRICS. And that's the strategy. So they're circling the wagons. They're trying to make sure that the Western countries, which are in basically the control of the United States, stay in that control, and that they don't start drifting off the paddock towards the alternative source of hegemony in the world today. So that's what they're doing.
It does seem as if this sort of squaring up for World War III, really, with IMF on one side and BRICS on the other side.
Well, I mean, what Putin said, as John mentioned, is that we're not anti-Western. We're just not the West, because of course China in particular has a very, very complicated relationship with the United States. China's main trading partner is the United States, so they don't want the United States to go down the drain, because that's their main customer. So in other words, there is what the Chinese call win-win cooperation is definitely possible. It's in everybody's interest to avoid a World War III and to try and solve all the problems that we face. The problem is that the financial oligarchy in the West that runs the deep state are not prepared to give up their position of privilege. It's quite clear that they're determined to try and keep the world as it was in the year 2000, when they ruled the roost and everybody else was on the floor. And they're just not prepared to adapt themselves to a changed reality.
So
The UK column was here in Bristol last week. I didn't know anything about it until afterwards. They were doing some sort of live event. And I noticed that they put out something last week, which was all about the idea that actually war itself is illegal, Martin.
Well, I mean, international law says that aggressive war is definitely illegal.
And actually, it's illegal to pay taxes towards your government when they are committing war crimes.
Well, I mean, people have made this kind of statement before, that, you know, in actual fact, natural law or universal law or some law that the UN has come up with means that we don't have to pay taxes to governments that go to war.
See, I don't know if you noticed a couple of weeks ago that we had a... who was our guest we had in who was talking about Wafa?
I don't know.
We had a guest in here the other week who was a Palestine activist here in Bristol.
You mean Rita?
Ah, Rita, yeah. She was saying there's something about this. She hinted at this, saying, oh, actually, we don't have to pay any taxes. It's all illegal.
Well, I mean, people can say this, and you can try... I mean,
but this is being run out by the UK column.
Well, I know,
this is what I'm pointing out.
Well,
this is
right.
A whole sort of
all
thing.
Right. I mean, it's not dissimilar to other things they've said in the past.
But this is... Anyway, so let's have a listen now to... This is about 3 or 4 minutes. And this, it'd be interesting to get your take, Martin. I listened to this thinking, is this really... is there really any point in this? And it's a chap... by the name of Chris Coverdale speaking on UK column last week.
Having established that there is in effect no basis for war and that the government and those that are supporting these activities are effectively in contravention of the International Criminal Courts Act 2001 sections 51 and 52, but going back to how that pertains to you or I, the individual, in terms of paying tax and the Terrorism Act, where does that get us to?
Right, it is important. Thank you, Charles, for raising that. In 1999, after again many, many years of attempting to get it agreed, there was an international convention agreed called the Convention for the Suppression of the Financing of Terrorism. Now, this is probably the second most important international convention or statute that we've got. It is now ratified by 188 nations. Ratification means bringing an international statute into domestic law. So domestic law of England and Wales or the domestic law of Scotland. Yes, we ratified that international convention with the Terrorism Act 2000 in this country, and that applies throughout Britain. And what it is it makes a criminal offence for one person to ask for money, to collect money, or to transfer money to another person or organisation if you suspect it may be used for the purposes of terrorism. And it defines terrorism as the use of firearms or explosives endangering life for a political or ideological cause. So that was the law brought into this country. And what I realized straight away was that any tax collector who was asking for money, demanding council tax or demanding income tax, whatever it was, inheritance tax, it was committing a criminal offense. And if they collected the money, that was a second criminal offence. And if I handed the money over, or if they, having collected it, handed it to the Revenue and Customs, then that was a third criminal offence. So it was not only a criminal offence for me to pay the tax, but a criminal offence for them to ask for it. And it was when I started to realise and go through the detail of that legislation, I realized how important it was that we use this legislation to ensure that our government uses all our money for lawful, legitimate purposes that never involve the use of firearms or explosives endangering life. Now, there was a very useful case, which I just referred to earlier, which was Mohammed Gul, Regina versus Gul, in which the Supreme Court said, looking at the definition of terrorism, this appears to apply to the military and quasi-military activities of the British government. Now, this is the Supreme Court saying, you know, basically, we are, the British government is committing acts of terrorism and funding terrorism when it gives orders to its military forces or the police to use armed force against anybody else.
So that's Chris Coverdale speaking on the UK column, Martin. What do you make of that? Is it a runner?
Well, I mean, you can make these claims as you wish, but I mean, the politics of it are quite clear. People can refuse to pay taxes. People refuse to pay the poll tax, for example. But you've got to make it stick, and the government has got to lack the power to force you to pay. But of course, governments do have the power to force you to pay. If you don't pay taxes, if you don't pay fines when you're fined, you get sent to prison, and the apparatus of the state is brought in to deal with you. It's a bit like the idea of natural law. You know, in natural law, you cannot have a power over me because there's a more powerful law, the natural law, that allows me to X, Y, and Z. You'll find, if you run up against the forces of the state, that the state is powerful, and that maybe it shouldn't be, maybe there shouldn't be a state, maybe there should be anarchy, but I'm afraid there is states, and states are more or less powerful. Some states are less powerful than others, but in Britain, if you're going to refuse to pay taxes, you will find that you're going to get into a lot of trouble.
So is this a basis for legal action, do you think, or is it just a rabbit hole?
I think it's just a rabbit hole, because he's been pushing this idea of making war illegal for a long time. And I'm, you know, in principle, I'm not against
it. Well, he said there's no legal basis for war.
Well, he can say that, but it's all, and he can say, but what it is he's setting himself up as the legal expert on all of these things, and I say there's no basis for war legally, but everybody's still fighting away, and they're the ones with the guns, and they decide whether they're going to do it or not, not you, Chris.
So I'll put a full version of that up on our show page. So, I mean, I just think, as you pointed out, Rita, when she came in, she was saying all this sort of thing. I mean, I do wonder whether whether there are quite a lot of these sort of nutter magnet things out there. The idea is to make, it is part of the zero trust agenda, or the idea is that, you know, both in mainstream press and in alternative press, actually journalists' jobs is to sort out the wheat from the chaff. So this is really interesting. This is solid. And this isn't. And the nutter magnet idea is that there will be sources like the UK column who put out all sorts of very accurate information, but also total and utter nonsense.
Well, I think it's also to do with individualism of our culture. People like to think that if they can take an individual action which absolves them from being involved, that they've somehow done the right thing. So remember that slogan, not in my name, in relation to the wars that we've been fighting. But you can say these things, but actually the solutions aren't individual. I mean, sometimes if you've got enough collective power, you can refuse to pay a tax, like the poll tax. People refuse to pay it, and eventually they have to withdraw it. But that's very rare that everybody comes together in that kind of way.
Did they? They didn't withdraw it.
Well, they turned
just
it into a council tax.
They tweaked it a little bit. Yeah. And, in fact, they used people's... the idea was that it was you had to pay the tax or you couldn't vote. And they just got rid of that idea. Although I think, actually, you'll find that if you do try and vote, they will track you down for council tax.
Well, that's...
They changed the name of it, basically.
But of course it's... but they also... original poll tax was everybody was going to play the same, the Duke of Westminster and me and you, which was clearly bonkers. But, you know, all of these things really come down to power. If you've got the power, you can stop a war. If you haven't got the power, then you can't, because you're not powerful enough to do it. And this legalism is... it's a kind of... the idea that we can, you know, there will come a moment where we'll go to a court and some guy with a horsehair wig will suddenly decide, no, in actual fact, the whole of the army is an illegal organisation. I don't think that's rational.
Well, not touched on there, of course, is the genocide implications right now for those financially supporting and verbally supporting what's going on in Gaza.
That's right. Now, what his extreme demand, we could get rid of war just by, you know, not paying our taxes, actually diverts us from things that we could be pursuing, like genocide charges against Keir Starmer, which is much more to the point, because it's not like a universal, we're going to get rid of war, it's just putting Keir Starmer in the dock, which is potentially doable. They've been given advice by their legal advisers that they shouldn't be supplying weapons to the Israelis, because they could be complicit in genocide, and they've not released that advice, because they know what it is, and it means that they are, in fact, potentially accusable of genocide. Now, that is actually something that might come to pass if they lose World War III, because they might lose. And then, of course, the victors will have their justice.
Where?
I don't know. It probably won't be in Nuremberg, because it'll be a Russian victory. Maybe it'll be somewhere in Russia. Kazan.
Maybe. All right. Also, another big story this week is the execution, some would call, or murder, or actually accidental death of Chris Cubber. He was shot dead by armed police in London. What do you make of this whole case, Martin? I think it was almost 2 years ago when it actually happened. It's finally come to court, and the police officer involved has been charged with murder, maybe, or manslaughter, certainly, and been acquitted this week.
Well, I mean, I don't know enough about the details of the individual case. Individual cases are individual.
Why don't we have a listen now to the report? This is before the announcement the day after the acquittal that apparently Chris Cubber had been a very dangerous and core member of a criminal gang, which I thought was a little bit of a strange way to... And by the way, his family were not asked about this at all. It was just a statement put out by the police in the days after. I mean, this it does sound to me as if this is a bit of a fix, actually. So how can you have a proper trial all the time that you're saying, oh, well, this person is okay
the reason why they didn't say all this stuff about him beforehand is because it would have prejudiced the jury. Whether they should say it afterwards, I really don't know, because it's basically, he wasn't armed when he was shot. So there's definitely a question to answer here, isn't there? Why did you shoot him? Why did you think he was armed? And of course, they said we thought he might be armed. Now, all of these things, individual cases make bad general rules. I don't know whether the police officer was justified in this case.
I'm going to guess why he was acquitted was because he simply refused to get. I mean, he was told to get out of the car by the police. He was surrounded by the police. Instead, he started ramming his own car into the police cars. Now, he'd probably still be alive if he just got out of the car, wouldn't he?
One would like to think so, but of course, what happened with Mark Duggan? He was shot dead, and that caused a lot. I mean, obviously, some people in the community are not going to be happy with this. They think that police are just getting away with murder.
Anyway, let's have a listen to a report on that now from Sky News.
Continuing southbound, M-Pass, what's your ETA?
Through South London, a convoy of police cars are following an Audi, linked to a shooting the night before.
Just standing by for strikes, stand by.
The officers box in the vehicle as it turns into a residential street.
On to Castle Garden. Do it here.
Oh, police! Show me your hands!
The Audi moves backwards and forwards. Then, following a frantic 17 seconds...
Mind them, he's going to try and go!
This dash cam and body-worn footage capture the sound and chaos. A split-second decision. Long-lasting reverberation. A not guilty verdict for Martin Blake, the officer who fired that bullet, saw hundreds of protesters outside the Old Bailey. On a day, a family and a community felt the justice system failed them. Chris Cabba's cousin had these words outside court on behalf of his parents.
Since Chris was stolen from us, and this decision shows his life and many others like him, doesn't matter to the system. Our son deserved better. The acquittal of Martin Blake isn't just a failure for our family, but for all those affected by police violence.
The Met Commissioner, walking a political tightrope, sent his commiserations to them while showing his support for Blake and trying to calm community tensions.
No police officer is above the law, but we have been clear that the system holding police to account is broken. I worry about the lack of support officers face for doing their best. But most of all, I worry for the public The more we crush the spirit of good officers, the less they can fight crime.
But people still came out to share their feelings and their frustrations.
The fury of the group gathered here isn't just about a not guilty verdict after a day of deliberation. They feel it's about years of systemic racism that they will continue to protest against.
Shingi Marike, Sky News, The Old Bailey.
So there you go, acquitted. Now I suppose you have to leave this sort of thing to the jury, Martin, but there was lots of... I mean, for example, Yvette Cooper, after all this, Home Secretary, has said that there will be no more naming of police during trials, so they will get protection of anonymity, almost like children do in cases. And this is something that apparently the police have lobbied for, because they've said, look, basically, if you they even said this to Mark Rowley, if you pursue this case, and the Crown Prosecution Service, if you pursue this case against Martin Blake, then we're going to lay all of us laying down our guns. Well, they did and they didn't. Some of them did, but there's a lot of pressure on the politicians to say, look, these police must be protected.
Well, there is, and you can see how tense this all is. Police officers who are armed police officers don't want to be ending up in court when they actually have to use the arms. The community itself is, believes possibly rightly that they're being targeted, and that, you know, if there had been a white person in the car, maybe they wouldn't have been shot. And that's definitely in the minds of the people who are protesting.
For me, and I think probably for the jury, the crucial thing is if this guy is going to start using his car as a battering ram against the police cars, then the obvious thing to do is to just be arrested and go through the court process. He'd still probably be alive.
Well, you may say that, Tony, and I wouldn't necessarily agree with you or disagree with you. I mean, this is why we have a criminal justice system with juries and all the rest of it. The police obviously want to cover their backsides. They don't want to, they don't, when they go out
some
there,
of these
they,
police,
they want to be able to do what they want without worrying about it.
Some of these police are themselves serious criminals.
Indeed. And then, of course, the whole problem really is the disadvantage of the black community over many, many years and their conflicts with the police. I used to live in Brixton in the 1980s. I know what it's about. Of course, there's a huge gulf of distrust there, and this kind of event doesn't do anything to resolve that, does it?
I think at the end of the day, though, do you think that they should be treated like children, these police, and they should go to court? I mean, the whole point is that the police, this is policing by consent, and that they are, these police officers are treated exactly as any other member of the public would be. If someone is killed, they're put through a trial, apparently their names have to be kept anonymous now.
Well, I think that's a fair...
Unless they're found guilty.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I think if we are going to have policing by consent, as you say, police officers have got to work to the same rules as they're enforcing. So if you shoot somebody out of hand, being a police officer is not going to protect you. But of course, if you can justify what you did, because you've, for whatever reason, then you've got the, this is going to be a very tense issue, whatever you do, because you're bound to make mistakes, even if the best people are going to make mistakes, and some people aren't the best people anyway. So, police shouldn't be above the laws they're enforcing. That's surely a matter of principle.
No, correct. But anyway, let's go. I mean, this is the third week I've been mentioning the name of Esther Ranson, which is bizarre, really. I never thought that this would happen, but the more I look into this, the more dodgy it all becomes. I'm going to play you now a clip, a little excerpt from the clip I played last week about her. This is the... I mean, Martin, do you want to just say something about this whole principle of assisted dying? Because many of the groups around the country who are against this are saying things, well, no, we want to be assisted to live, because what's happened over the last decade, certainly since 2008, what we've seen is a dismantling of the elderly care and palliative care, end-of-life care. And so there is a lot of pressure on families and people saying, well, actually, look, you're just in the way now, because no one's going to care for you. Maybe it's time you just jumped off the cliff.
Well, during the austerity era of Osborne, the life expectancy in this country went down for the first time in hundreds of years. So loads of people definitely did die because they weren't properly looked after because of the austerity policy to balance the books and keep the debt down and all the rest of it, to fulfil the fiscal rules which you've set yourself. I'm agnostic on this. I'm willing to listen to a debate about it. Obviously, there's a danger that people can be pressured by relatives into deciding to die when they don't really want to because they want the money or they just want them out of the way because it's inconvenient. So that's got to be protections against that. On the other hand, I know various people who've said to me that they wouldn't want, and I wouldn't want, to be living a miserable existence. And of course, what tends to happen, as Dr. Halpin pointed out the other week, is you just don't intervene. You don't have another round of operations, for example. So you're not actually helping them to die, but you're not going to have another round of operations because obviously it's going to be very difficult and problematic for people, and they might as well just be allowed to die once you've reached that point. And that happens every day in every hospital.
It does. So so this lady, Shai Keenan, just to fill you in, folks, she accused Esther Ranson of, well, she said, I informed Esther Ranson about Jimmy Savile many years before it was all revealed, and she ran this thing called Childline. I had hoped that she would have done something about it, but she didn't. So let's just refresh your memory on the pertinent bit of last week's clip.
There are very few women do you speak to who didn't feel that they were in some way subjected to unwanted attention but didn't feel that they could say anything to anyone. Yeah. The reports in The Sun today, Shai Keenan, who is an anti-abuse campaigner, she said that she alerted you to concerns about Jimmy Savile 18 years ago.
She says, I have no memory even of meeting her, but
there's a photograph of you here with her.
I don't know where it was taken. It could have been in a green room.
Yeah, so the first thing that happened was Esther Ranson denied meeting this woman. Actually, it's obvious that she had actually met her in the photograph. But then what happened was this lady, Shai Keenan, Martin, had a horrific campaign of abuse against her started, literally just basically not long after that interview took place that you just heard. And there were all sorts of smears and attacks on her through Twitter, through emails, in all sorts of social media by a lady who said basically, look, this woman is not who she says she is, she's just faking her abuse and this sort of thing. So this was a whole nother aspect to the which I didn't realize. So Shai Keenan herself, because she said these things, suddenly came under attack, literally to drive her. I mean, she came out with a book about it all, and she was told by this particular woman from, I think it was from Shropshire somewhere, that she was a complete fraud and a fake, and this virtually destroyed the woman. In fact, she took her to court for harassment. But this sort of thing is pretty worrying, isn't it? When you get some sort of accusation like that, for suddenly that all hell breaks loose and somebody's on your case.
Well, it's all, this is all to do with details of individual cases, which I haven't got access to.
I'll give you a little bit more information about it then, because this case took place just about 2 years after you heard that interview. And it was Dame Esther accuses the Colchester campaigner, that's Shai Keenan, of smearing her with false accusations about Jimmy Savile. This is back in 2015. Mm-hmm. Esther Ranson gave evidence as a witness for the defence during a stalking trial. Defendant Penny Mellor, mother of eight, this is the one who'd been harassing Shai Keenan, told the court she's being set up and asked Dame Esther to appear to tell the jury about some of the alleged lies by the victim, Shai Keenan. Mellor, 53, of Coven, Wolverhampton, sent hundreds of tweets to Shai Keenan between October 2013 and March 2013 and was charged with stalking Shai Keenan with the intention of causing harassment, serious alarm and distress. So she denied the charge and claims she sent the tweets in response to Shai Keenan's book Broken and an article in The Sun concerning Dame Esther. She accuses Ms. Keenan of lying in both publications. She told Chelmsford Crown Court yesterday, Shai Keenan is untrustworthy. I was challenging the veracity of her claim. So she's just basically come out of nowhere and attacked this woman. Anyway, their final result of the case was she was found guilty and asked to do some community service. But I was just shocked that Esther Ransom would have the audacity to turn up in court to defend this woman who'd been attacking this woman, Shai Keenan, who'd been abused as a youngster.
Well, as you say, there was a court case and it was upheld that she'd been abused, you know, she'd been harassing Shai Keenan. Incidentally, of course, what would she know about Shai Keenan? How does she know Shai Keenan? How does she know whether she's lying? I mean, she's a random person, isn't she?
Well, it almost seemed to me as if she was put up to it.
Well, and Esther Ransom turns up to testify on her behalf. Maybe she was put up to it, but there's no, it's too thin to. I don't know what happened here.
The court decided that this woman had been harassing her, deliberately harassing her. She didn't get a custodial sentence, really just a kind of rap on the knuckles. I just look at Esther Ransom as a very toxic character in all of this, because what's she doing coming to defend someone who's. She's supposed to be the person who's founder of Childline. Here's someone, Shai Keenan, who was abused as a youngster and has had the courage to come out with her story. And actually what Esther Rance is doing is she's coming on court to defend someone who's been persecuting her. Anyway, I know it's not your kind of thing really, Martin, but I thought it's interesting to get to the bottom of that one. And I'll put some links up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the case, further raising questions about Esther Ransom's suitability, not only to be pushing this whole idea and cheerleading for assisted dying, but also for setting up something like Childline. I mean, how trustworthy is she? Or was she, even now? The next piece is on the US elections. What do you make of this is all coming rather soon now, Martin? Who's going to win?
Well, I think because Kamala Harris will not come out and condemn what's happening in Gaza, large parts of the Democratic base are not going to vote for her. They're not going to vote for Trump either, because his position on Israel is even worse than Kamala Harris's. So it's likely they're in the swing states, because, of course, it's first past the post-electoral college stuff. In the swing states, she needs to win. A significant chunk of her own people aren't going to vote for her. And that means that Trump will probably win, but I guess it will be less than 50% of the electorate.
So what we've got here,
we could have a colour revolution.
Is genocide or genocide, you think? But surely people are going to vote for Trump because they know that the Democrats and Harris are pro-Israel.
Well, they know that both Trump and the Democrats are pro-Israel. So if you're at all worried about this issue, and obviously Arab Americans are, and so are many younger people who are the Democrats' sort of core supporters in universities and colleges, they're not going to vote for Kamala Harris because she won't condemn the genocide. But they won't vote for Trump. They'll vote for Jill Stein if she's on the ballot. And by doing that, in the rigged system that the US is, Trump will win, but he'll probably win with less than half of the vote. Now, of course, if that happened in Venezuela, we'd be immediately demanding people to go into the streets and overturn the result and say we're not going to accept it. Just because it's been there since the 18th century doesn't mean that the US Constitution is democratic. It isn't. Quite frequently, Trump, when he was elected, had less votes than Hillary Clinton. And of course, in some other countries, people say, well, you can't be the president then.
So let's have a listen to a bit of Trump and Harris. Starting with this, I mean, one of the things I find slightly weird about, there seems to be a lot of psychological warfare going on. In other words, getting the candidates to say certain things which are designed to sort of trigger the voters. I suppose, I mean, you said it a couple of weeks ago, it's a very dirty game, American politics, Martin.
Well, it is, and of course it's all to do with, you know, trying to persuade, it's only a small slice of the electorate who will decide the result. It's the swing voters in the swing states. And so that you can imagine all the political operatives in the US are totally focused on the pea brains of these people. And they've got to think, well, what do they care about? as the same thing happens in this country, where it's less than a million people who decide British elections in the swing constituents.
The big similarity is there's a very narrow choice, actually, isn't it? It's an incredibly narrow choice.
And it narrows the choice down so that if you want anything else, you can whistle.
Increasingly, our elections are becoming about getting rid of somebody awful. What's the best way to tactically vote and do that, both in Britain and America?
Well, I think the tactical voting for Kamala Harris would have been secure if she'd taken a strong position on Gaza. But lots of people are not going to vote for her because they say you are complicit in genocide, and I'm not going to vote for you on that basis. And we had Matt here from New Zealand talking about if he was American, he would probably vote for Trump because RFK's in Trump's camp now, and so is Tulsi Gabbard. But the thing is, if you vote for Trump and he then goes and he then gives a green light to the Israelis to start World War III and nuke Iran, you are responsible for that because you voted for him. Of course, he's from New Zealand, so he doesn't get a vote, and I don't get a vote either. So we're all watching this Punch and Judy show, and in actual fact, it's going to be massively consequential for everybody else, but we don't get a say in it.
Well, they have these things called the town halls over there, don't they, which are these sort of cosy chit-chats with the candidates.
Well, what it is supposedly them meeting the punters, but it's all very rigged and scripted.
It tends to be a bit like that. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Kamala. Well, some of the things I find fascinating about Kamala Harris is she seems to be very focused on a sort of appealing to the emotions rather than talking about policies.
If I can just speak to what people are feeling. We cannot despair. We cannot despair. You know, the nature of a democracy is such that I think there's a duality. On the one hand, there's an incredible strength when our democracy is intact. An incredible strength in what it does to protect the freedoms and rights of its people. Oh, there's great strength in that. And it is very fragile. It is only as strong as our willingness to fight for it. And so that's the moment we're in. And I say do not despair, because in a democracy, as long as we can keep it in our democracy, the people, every individual has the power to make a decision about what this will be. And so let's not feel powerless. Let's not let overwhelming nature of this all make us feel powerless, because then we have been defeated. And that's not our character as the American people. We are not one to be defeated. We rise to a moment and we stand on broad shoulders of people who have fought this fight before for our country. And in many ways, let us look at the challenge then that we are being presented and not be overwhelmed by it. The baton is now in our hands to fight for, not against, but for this country we love. That's what we have the power to do. So let's own that. Dare I say, be joyful in what we will do in the process of owning that, which is knowing that we can and will build community and coalitions and remind people that we're all in this together. Let's not let the overwhelming nature of this strip us of our strength. That's how I feel about this.
Big round of applause for Kamala Harris there, Martin, but not a lot of policy. I mean, to be fair, she is talking policy too, but I'm not sure that really made a lot of sense other than, please like me.
Yeah, and I'm afraid that US politics is very like Love Island, isn't it, really? I mean, that's the problem with it.
Really? Why?
Yes, because it's all about the personality of the person. Yeah.
Not necessarily. I mean, it's about the wit as well.
Well, indeed, yes.
Policies come into it.
Listening as an English listener is the kind of whiny, self narcissistic kind of, we, us, I, it's all about feelings.
She's quite nurturing, isn't she? She's trying to nurture everyone, and everyone will be happy if
they're
nurtured.
She's probably being advised by her advisors to come across as a sort of cuddly mummy as opposed to you know, Trump the bully, yeah? So that she's trying to make herself sound much more cuddly and you know, I'm on your side, I understand your problems, I'm middle class too, and all of that stuff. So that's what she's trying to do.
Anyway, Trump was talking about what you were saying, which is the whole business with the wars. I mean, this is what everyone, the whole world is watching this election, because we want to know what the hell is going to happen with the relationship between the United States and Israel.
We're going to take care of Israel, and they know that. Bibi called me yesterday, called me the day before. We have a very good relationship. And I have to say they've done, fortunately, they didn't listen to Biden, because if they listened to Biden, they'd right now be waiting for a bomb to drop on them. And they did their own work. They did not listen. They couldn't listen. So we're going to do a lot for Israel, and we're behind them. And the big thing, we want to have peace in the Middle East. We want to have Russia stop with Ukraine. We're going to get that done. That was another thing would have never happened. You wouldn't have had inflation. You wouldn't have had Russia attacking Ukraine. You wouldn't have had October 7th, which was Israel. And the horrible, most embarrassing moment in the history of our country was Afghanistan. We're going to get things turned around in this country, because it's so bad. They don't do that except in third world countries. Nobody thought it was even possible. Nobody thought it was even possible. They used to talk about it before all this stuff happened. And they say, well, it'll never happen because it's never happened before. And think of the scoundrels that are in office right now. It didn't happen to them. So I just want to thank you, actually, for your support, because it actually made me more popular. We're going to have a November 5th, and you'll probably, many of you have, who's already voted? It's going to be a big one. I think it's the most important election in the history of our country. I really believe that. I was in North Carolina yesterday, three different stops, and I followed it in. I actually followed the hurricane in. I went there, and it is not even believable, but FEMA, meaning the White House, did not do their job. They did not do their job. Interest rates were 2%. Now they're at 10%, and you can't get the money. We're going to drill, baby, drill, and that's going to bring everything down. Okay? That's going to bring everything down, because it's such a big component of the fabric of our life economically.
My question to you is, how quickly can you shut down the border for us to stop the drugs from coming in? So
Marty, it's going to be the first order. It'll be done in the first hour of the first day.
As I was up in front of this very massive rally, we're going to one with, I think, 20,000 people right now, right after that. But we're taking care of you first. I brought it up, and it was interesting because I realized the time is coming to an end. This is the greatest movement in the history of our country, MAGA. Make America great again. Make America great. And in many ways it's sad, because we're down to 12 days. We've been doing this together for 9 years, and it's down to 12 days. We had the greatest rallies. We had the biggest rallies, the most beautiful people. But I just wanted to say, so we've had this journey together that has been incredible. There's never been anything like it. And I realize that we'll be doing it for literally just a few more days. And then it comes to an end. And then hopefully we'll do another journey. And that will be the journey to make America better than it's ever been.
So that's a compilation from several days, and I think a bit from last week by the sounds of it. We're talking about the hurricane, but yeah, I mean, he's pretty clear about Israel. We are supporting Israel. He doesn't really say much about supporting Gaza, Martin.
Well, no, and that's, you know, if he wins, he says he's going to sort out the Ukrainian situation. I think the Russians may be prepared to talk to him, but they might not, because they just don't trust the Americans at all. They don't.
Putin said he wanted Kamala to win, didn't he?
He did, but I think he said it with a smile on his face, because he's just trying to wind the West up, because he knows about all the things that are said in the West about how Putin's, he's a friend of Putin and so on.
Okay, Trump has attacked Biden and his opponent Harris. Great article, actually, in the Middle East Eye. Donald Trump, his diplomatic legacy in Israel, Palestine and the Middle East. Trump has attacked Biden and his opponent Harris, by declaiming that they are holding Israel back from being able to achieve its war aims in Gaza. Now, this sounds a bit unhinged.
Well, it is. And of course, Netanyahu, because he knows that Trump might win, he's under no pressure whatsoever to give in to any pressure from the Americans to go slow on what he's trying to do. So the clear implication of this is that the war is going to escalate either before November the 5th polling day, because the Israelis may decide to you know, escalate just before the election,
yeah,
or they may just leave it till after the election.
Well, they're escalating this week, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. So it may well be that before America goes to the polls on November the 5th,
there's an escalation every week at the moment.
There's going to be a major war.
A new front opened, mass slaughter. Trump has made it clear that despite his party's emphasis on free speech protections, he viewed the ongoing mass pro-Palestine mobilization in American streets with absolute vitriol and painted a grim picture of how he would treat any criticism of Israel if he were to be elected again. He said, "We have the Palestinians and we have everybody else rioting all over the place. You talk about Charlottesville. This is 100 times Charlottesville," Trump said during a presidential debate in July, equating pro-Palestinian activism with a 2017 attack by white supremacists in Virginia.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, the hypocrisy of his freedom of speech is absurd. I mean, he wants to be able to say whatever ever wants to say, including that, you know, Israel can kill anybody it wants. But anybody who protests against that, that's against American values and we're going to lock you up. Now, in actual fact, those who see Trump as a potential dictator are probably right. And as I said, it's quite possible he will win with less than 50% of the vote. And in any other country, the Americans would be encouraging the people to go into the streets and say, "We're not accepting that result." And of course, in other countries, they might go into the streets and the police might beat them up or something. But in America, people have got guns. So it may well be that you could have gun battles after this election that's coming up. Because people are not necessarily going to accept the result if they think they've won.
Despite Trump spending the last several months boasting about being a banty war president, several sporadic Trump decisions could have seen the US get further entangled in conflict in the region. Trump ordered the launch of 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles at the Shayarat Air Base in Syria, which is controlled by the Assad government. And in a surprise move, Trump, on the 3rd of January 2020, ordered a drone strike that killed senior Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, Iraqi military leader Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The assassinations caused widespread fear that a war could break out between Iran and the US. I mean, you mentioned this quite a bit, Martin. Do you think it's possible that the extreme measures taken by the Israelis since this mass genocide, coming up for 50,000 at least people killed by the Israelis just because they happen to be Palestinian and living in Gaza, this genocide, that might have actually touched Trump at all?
No, because he's taking $100 million from Adelson's widow, and he's promised her that he will definitely allow the annexation of the West Bank and probably the annexation of Gaza as well. So his funders are Zionist billionaires, and they want, and he's made a big issue about how he's super, super pro-Israeli, and in actual fact, Biden and Kamala Harris are really Palestinians in disguise, which is ludicrous, but that's what he's claiming. Jill Stein, who's, you know, on the ballot in many states, she is Jewish, but she's absolutely opposed to what's going on. She's against the genocide, and I think lots of the more radical Democrat voters will vote for her as a protest against everything that's going on. But of course, she won't win. The result of that, Trump will win, and then the war will escalate. And then, of course, hopefully Israel will lose, because they're not winning the military battle. They've won the hearts and minds of people like Trump, but they haven't won the hearts and minds of people in the Middle East.
Well, we've heard the last couple of days that apparently Trump is a fascist. Let's have a listen to a clip of that now.
We have breaking news. Vice President Harris is speaking at the residence before she participates in a CNN town hall tonight in Chester Township. Let's listen.
He said he wanted generals like Adolf Hitler had. Donald Trump said that because he does not want a military that is loyal to the United States Constitution. He wants a military that is loyal to him. He wants a military who will be loyal to him personally. One that will obey his orders even when he tells them to break the law or abandon their oath to the Constitution of the United States. In just the past week, Donald Trump has repeatedly called his fellow Americans the enemy from within, and even said that he would use the United States military to go after American citizens. And let's be clear about who he considers to be the enemy from within. Anyone who refuses to bend a knee or dares to criticize him would qualify in his mind as the enemy within, like judges, like journalists, like nonpartisan election officials. It is deeply troubling and incredibly dangerous that Donald Trump would invoke Adolf Hitler, the man who is responsible for the deaths of 6 million Jews and hundreds of thousands of Americans. All of this is further evidence for the American people of who Donald Trump really is. This is a window into who Donald Trump really is, from the people who know him best, from the people who worked with him side by side in the Oval Office and in the Situation Room. And it is clear from John Kelly's words that Donald Trump is someone who, I quote, certainly falls into the general definition of fascist, who in fact vowed to be a dictator on day one and vowed to use the military as his personal militia to carry out his personal and political vendettas. Donald Trump is increasingly unhinged and unstable. And in a second term, people like John Kelly would not be there to be the guardrails against his propensities and his actions. Those who once tried to stop him from pursuing his worst impulses would no longer be there, and no longer be there to rein him in. So the bottom line is this. We know what Donald Trump wants. He wants unchecked power. The question in 13 days will be, what do the American people want? Thank you.
So that's Kamala Harris spelling it out. John Kelly, Kerry, is it, or Kelly?
I think it's Kelly, because he was one of Trump's appointees, wasn't it? Yeah. Kerry's a Democrat.
Yeah, the point here is apparently the deep state, if Trump gets in, might be gone, and so Trump will be able to do what he wants. But there's lots and lots in there. Do you think, is he right? Does Trump fit into this definition of a fascist? We know, don't we, that George Bush Senior's father actually did try a fascist coup in the United States.
Well, yes.
Before the Second World War.
It was a coup, whether it was a fascist. The problem with the word fascist is that it's been used so often.
How do you define it then?
Well, there's a tight definition which refers literally to Italians in the 1920s. That's the original fascists. But of course,
can you be a fascist non-dictator?
Well, yes, you can have dictators who aren't fascists. Julius Caesar wasn't a fascist.
No, but how about the other way around? Can you have fascists who are not dictators?
Well, there are fascists who would like to be dictators who are not in power. Oh. Of course, Smotrich in Israel is both a self-declared fascist, and he's in power, and he's killing people.
Okay, so does Trump fit the bill?
I think Trump is problematic. I wouldn't vote for him, not least because of what he just said about Israel, for example.
Is he a fascist, Martin? Is this a bit of cheeky electioneering?
It's cheeky electioneering. It's a useless word, really, unless you're going to specify what you mean by it.
What she seems to be saying to me is that he wants dictatorial power. She's saying things like he wants to use the US Army as his personal militia.
Well, he himself said that he wants to stop people protesting, pro-Palestine protesters, and he's going to crush them. Now, is that fascism or is that just dictatorship?
Well, unstable? I mean, he certainly doesn't say...
He's unstable.
What about Biden? Is he... Biden on a staircase is not very stable.
No. Well, I mean, I think the rest of the world is watching this in horror, yeah. Because it's quite clear that nobody who gets elected is going to be able to change the direction of the policy on Israel or anything else. The deep state in the US is, I mean, did you see what Trump was saying about anybody who tries to get rid of the dollar, we're going to crush their economy? Yeah. So he's not.
Well, they can try. I mean, they've been trying to do that for decades.
Yeah,
haven't they?
That's right. Well, he will try.
Can they? Could they do that?
Well, no. This is the problem. Trump. One of the things Trump's going to bring is in loads of sanctions or tariffs on Chinese and other goods. Now you can do that, but all that does really is it massively increases inflation for your people because they've got to buy more expensive stuff from your local producers rather than cheaper stuff from somewhere else. Now, if you're going to do that, you've got to give them more money. But how are you going to give them more money? Well, the economy's just going to grow, is it? Maybe there's just going to be a big... See, if we have a major war in the Middle East, the oil price is going to go through the roof, the economy will crash, and if it doesn't crash, you'll get hyperinflation unless interest rates go, and then the economy crashes. The Western way of doing things is coming to an end, and it doesn't matter who the Americans elect as their president, the capitalist system is in crisis.
Oh, no, because they're going to drill, baby, drill.
Well, even if they do, they can't change this. They can't change the realities that Russian oil is far, far cheaper than anything they can drill, and you know the demand and the supply won't add up. And of course, if the Iranians close the Strait of Hormuz, that would be very good for oil people who invested in oil. They'll make a lot of money. The oil majors make loads of money out of that, but the economy will go down the drain, smashed. But it won't be so true for the Russians because they've got plenty of oil.
Anyway, I was looking around over the last couple of years, before he was taken ill, Noam Chomsky had some interesting things, the US MIT intellectual, about asking this really crucial question: what's in it for us, for America? And here he is now with his take on why does the US support Israel?
Why does the United States support Israel? Well, there's a history, and a very interesting one. It actually goes back a long time. One thing to remember is that Christian Zionism is a very powerful force, which goes back long before Jewish Zionism. In England particularly, Christian Zionism was a powerful force among British elites. It's part of the motivation for the Balfour Declaration and for Britain's support for Jewish colonization of Israel. Remember, the Bible said, you know, and that's a big part of British elite culture. Same in the United States. Woodrow Wilson was a devout Christian who read the Bible every day. So did Harry Truman in the Roosevelt administration. One of the leading officials, Harold Ickes, once described the return of the Jews to Palestine as the greatest event in history. It's realizing the lesson of the Bible. These are deeply religious countries in which the biblical commands, so-called, are taken quite literally. Also, this is just part of colonization. This is the last phase of European colonization. And notice that the countries that are most strongly in support of Israel are not just the United States. It's the United States, Australia, and Canada, the offshoots of England, Anglosphere sometimes called, unusual forms of imperialism. These are settler colonial societies. Societies in which not like the British in India, say, societies in South Africa is a little like this, or Algeria under the French, settler colonial societies in which the settlers came in, essentially eliminated the native population, also driven by religious principles, very religious groups driven by Christian Zionism. Those are major cultural factors. There are also significant geostrategic factors. You go back to 1948, there was actually a split between the State Department and the Pentagon in the United States over how to react to the new state of Israel. The State Department was not committed strongly to Israeli conquests, the establishment of the state, and was concerned about the refugees. It wanted an implementation of the refugee problem. The Pentagon, on the other hand, was very impressed with Israel's military potential. The Israeli military successes, if you look back at the internal record and declassified, the Joint Chiefs of Staff described Israel as the second largest military force in the region after Turkey and a potential base for U.S. power in the region. That continued can't run through the whole record, but in 1958, when there was a serious crisis in the region, Israel was the only state that strongly cooperated with Britain and the United States, and it won plenty of support from the governments and the military for that reason. 1967 is when the current relations with Israel were pretty much established. Israel performed a major service to the United States by destroying a secular Arab nationalism, a major enemy of the United States, and supporting radical Islam, which the U.S. supported. And it continues right until the present. Right now, we saw an example of that just during the latest Gaza attack. You recall that at one point, Israel began to run out of munitions during the assault, despite the fact that it's armed to the teeth. The United States provided Israel with additional munitions through the Pentagon. And notice where they were taken from. These were U.S. munitions pre-positioned in Israel for eventual use by U.S. forces. One of many signs of how Israel is regarded as essentially a military offshoot of the United States. Very close intelligence relations that go way back. Many other connections. And the media tend to take up, to support the policy of the government with very few, you know, kind of little questioning around the edges, but basically accept the policy. So, for example, take another issue. Take the U.S. invasion of Iraq. You cannot find the phrase U.S. invasion of Iraq in the U.S. media. There was obviously an invasion, a blatant act of aggression, a textbook case of that's Nuremberg trials called the supreme international crime, cannot be mentioned. President Obama is praised as an opponent of the invasion. And what did he say? He said it's a mistake. It's a strategic blunder. We're not going to get away with it. Now, that's the kind of opposition that you heard from the German general staff during Hitler's invasion of Russia. It's a blunder. Shouldn't do it. We should knock off England first. Now, that's regarded as opposition. The same in Vietnam. There's now a commemoration underway, big commemoration of U.S. sacrifices in Vietnam. Try to find the phrase U.S. invasion of South Vietnam there or anywhere in the past year since 1961 when it took place. Non-existent, maybe on Democracy Now, what I write, but way out at the fringe. And this is not unique to the United States. Take, say, Britain. Right now there's interesting debates in the British literary journals, like the Times Literary Supplement, as to whether Britain should finally begin to recognize the genocidal, the word that's used, genocidal character of British colonization hundreds of years ago. Should Britain begin to face it? You know, you can ask that question in many places. The tendency of the intellectual community to go along like a herd in support of state power, private power, is just overwhelming. Intellectuals like to think of themselves as dissident, critical, courageous, standing up against power. Absolutely untrue. You look at the historical record, that's a small fringe, and they're usually punished. The mainstream tends to be what was once called a herd of independent minds, marching in support of state power. Nothing new here. Unfortunate, you have to fight against it, not new.
I mean, we've known about all these things for years, those who pay attention, but sadly, nothing seems to get any better and they carry on doing all these terrible things.
I mean, he says lots of interesting things there. One of them, fascinating, lots and lots of interesting bits and bobs. Secular Arab nationalism was crushed by the United States in favour of radical Islam.
Yep. Well, that was the British...
Interesting, isn't it?
That was the British policy in relation to people in Egypt who were you know, pushing for, you know, independence of Egypt, or, you know, basically leaving the British Empire, they encouraged the Muslim Brotherhood because they saw the Muslim Brotherhood as being more kind of reactionary. They weren't really interested in politics. They just wanted to tell people what to do with their sex lives and things like that. So the West definitely encouraged from a very early stage the idea of Islamic fundamentalism as a means to prevent secular nationalists from making their case that we need a fairer shape. You know, we want you out of our country. And we want a bigger slice of the pie. And then, of course, that then morphed into the creation of Al Qaeda. Al Qaeda didn't exist. It wasn't an independent organisation that came into existence. It was created by British and US taxes to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. Because at that stage, you see, the Russians were communists and they didn't believe in God. But these Muslim fundamentalists, they do believe in God. Therefore, they're on our side. So we're going to train them how to blow things up and kill people, and we're going to infiltrate them into Afghanistan to do that. And that's what we're going to do. And we're going to fund it by selling heroin on the streets of Britain and the United States, which is what happened.
So before the break, and we'll be looking after the break at World War III, at Halloween. What's Halloween really all about? Why is it being pushed so much to our kids and supermarkets and that sort of thing? But before that, Martin, the Dominion voting scheme. We had a couple of weeks ago, and Don touched on it, the dangers of this electronic voting system. But I noticed that there are some serious concerns about this company Dominion, who controls these voting machines, and isn't it funny how last year when Tucker Carlson was sacked from Fox News, that was actually over the story he did about Dominion voting machines? So in a way, we're supposed to have forgotten about that. But actually, these voting machines are completely crucial when it comes to actually having a free and fair election.
Well, I believe they sued those who said that they'd stolen the election, and they won in court. I think
No, it didn't go to court. It was an out-of-court settlement by Murdoch, where there was a secret agreement that Tucker Carlson was going to be removed from Fox.
Okay.
And Dominion then said, okay, well, we won't sue you then.
Right. So it's all, you know, you focus on electronic, there's electronic voting in Venezuela, but you also put in a paper ballot. So there's two that, you know, you vote
twice.
You
said something this year about the elections there where the, what was it about the electronic voting in Venezuela?
What happened was that before the election in Venezuela, independent polling organizations, they were suggesting that Maduro would win in the first round, but it would be very close. And of course, in Venezuela, like in Russia or France, if you don't get 50% in the first round, there has to be a second round. Doesn't happen in the US. You can just get in with less than 50% of the vote, which is probably what's going to happen. But anyway, the way the system works in Venezuela, and Jimmy Carter went out there years ago to look into what they were doing. They tried to make it as absolutely fair as possible. Everybody gets a paper ballot and an electronic ballot. And if there's any dispute about the electronic ballot, then the paper ballots are counted. Okay, so there's actually a double jeopardy system.
So why bother with the electronic one?
Because it's quicker and it gets it done.
Oh, it's quicker.
Well, anyway,
cheaper.
Anyway, what happened with the electronic one? You did ask me what I yeah. said a couple of weeks ago, a few weeks ago now. They were going. The main electoral council had called it for Maduro with 98% vote counted and said it looks like he's won. But what the opposition had done for weeks and weeks before the election, they had their own polling people who were saying that they were going to win on a landslide with 70%. That was very, very unlikely, and these polls were clearly wrong. But nevertheless, by saying that in the run-up to the election, they then put themselves in a position to say on the day, as soon as the polls closed, the opposition said it was a cheat and we won. And then they tried to overturn the result. At the same time, the way that could have been resolved is for the electoral commission in Venezuela to get the electronic vote, you know, show that the electronic vote was tallied with the other vote. But they couldn't do that because it was all hacked. So in other words, there was an attempt to remove Maduro by A, paying NGOs inside Venezuela to claim that the opposition had 60-70% of the vote, which is patently not the case, and then of course to claim that because they didn't get 60-70% of the vote that they must have been cheated. Now, in actual fact, it's all fallen out now. I mean, if Maduro had got less than half the vote, there'd have been a runoff, which he would probably have won. But in any case, he was representing Venezuela in Kazan this week, because the rest of the world is quite happy with that result. The only people who won't accept it, of course, are the West.
Well, that's interesting. I think this connection with Venezuela and electronic voting is quite interesting. One could be cynical and think, well, the Americans have been planning this for years. They're actually quite afraid that the Venezuelan people and the Venezuelan state country might be leading much of Latin America against the imperialism of the United States. So they want to fix their voting systems from some computer terminal like IBM.
Yes, well, I mean, I believe the Venezuelans themselves put this system in place because they knew they were going to face all of this stuff. Chavez, when he was in power, knew exactly what was going to happen. And, of course, he did win very convincingly every time there was a military coup against him, which failed. And, of course, it's a very divided society. The wealthy in Venezuela
He was then poisoned, I believe, wasn't he?
Yes, probably was. He died of He had four rare cancers. Cuban doctors cured him of the first three, and then he died of another one. Lots of Latin American left-wing leaders died of very obscure cancers during this period, and plenty of people in Latin America believe that was the Americans who did that. Now, what kind of democracy can you have when a foreign country can kill the person you elected and there's no comeback?
This is hence BRICS, really, because people are getting fed up with this so-called post-colonial. But actually, it's the new colonial system using the IMF. Anyway, let's have a listen now to this piece about the dodgy Dominion voting system.
As we conducted investigations against the Cartel del Sol and presented them one after another to the U.S. Department of Justice, we noticed and pursued leads from the cartel's money laundering operations to the world of non-governmental organizations and election companies. After witnessing election irregularities associated with the 2020 U.S. presidential election, we decided to direct time and resources to Cartel del Sol links to U.S. and global election fraud. After an exhaustive 3.5-year investigation, it is indisputable. Smartmatic Election Systems was created at the direction of now-deceased Venezuelan dictator Hugo Chavez, and its source code, the basis of its operating system, developed jointly by Venezuela's Consejo Nacional Electoral and Smartmatic, was designed to allow election results to be altered without the knowledge of voters and the public. Additionally, the Venezuelan CNE holds ownership of Smartmatic's source code. Each time the Venezuelan CNE and Smartmatic update the source code, a copy of it is stored at the vault at the Venezuelan Central Bank. In 2005, a European Union Electoral Observation Mission to Venezuela published a report stating the Venezuelan regime owns Smartmatic source code. The Venezuelan government signed that report as factual. Smartmatic's first election in Venezuela was the 2003 recall election of Hugo Chavez. The CNE director at the time, Jorge Rodriguez, at the direction of the Cuban Directorate General of Intelligence, DGI, hired three Venezuelan-American computer engineers that were graduates of Simón Bolívar University, a Venezuelan university linked to the U.S. university, MIT. They had already registered a software company in Delaware and opened an office for it in Boca Raton. The engineers, Antonio Mujica, Roger Peñate, and Alfredo Anzola, established Smartmatic at the direction of the Venezuelan regime, built the source code, and flew off to Italy to buy lottery machines from Olivetti to serve as election hardware.
So although that's done from a very anti-Venezuelan point of view, the fact of the matter is, well, I'm not sure the name of the guy, but they're... their investigation stands into Smartmatic and Dominion and the ownership of these voting companies, and also these particular people. Now, they were Venezuelans, but it could be that they're just working for the Americans by creating a voting system which can then be hacked without people realizing. I mean, that's this is, in a way, you know, it's a bit weird because you're hearing something which is from a very pro-US, anti-Venezuelan point of view, but the facts still stand that these voting systems are created deliberately in order to hack elections. So all this stuff about the Russians trying to fix elections, actually Dominion voting, and I hope hopefully they'll sue us for saying this, but Dominion voting are trying to fix elections with these election machines.
It's unlikely that the deep state in the US would be trying to help to get Chavez re-elected.
So they're doing the opposite. They're trying to control the Venezuelan elections, Martin. Surely you can see that.
Yeah, the Venezuelans will have brought in their system to try and prevent the Americans from bumping Chavez out. And the idea that the Venezuelan government actually owns the electoral, the companies which run the voting, well, you'd expect that, wouldn't you? They're the government. So that's what they'd want to happen. Now, there is a question about, you know, we could talk about the Venezuelan elections, how free or fair they were. I think that the West has just not been able to accept that Venezuelans do not want to vote for the right wing in their country. And those that don't like it have left. Many of them have left and they don't vote anymore in the country. So it's quite likely that Maduro did indeed get the 51% of the vote that he got.
Well, I think you're missing the point here. This is an electoral voting system which is designed to be hackable, whether it's in America or Venezuela.
No, the ones in Venezuela are not connected to the internet for a very good reason, so they can't be hacked. But of course,
you just told us earlier on they had been hacked.
All right. I don't know the full details of the system, Tony. Okay, now if electoral fraud is being carried out through electronic voting, then the evidence needs to be brought forward and people need to look into it. But let's point out another thing about when Donald Trump was elected. Even if there was electoral fraud, which deprived him of the swing states when he got elected, and when he didn't get elected last time, he still got millions less votes than Biden and millions less votes than Hillary Clinton. He's only able to be elected because of the Electoral College.
Actually, what we're talking about,
it's not electronics. Yeah, okay. It was designed in the 18th century
about here,
to keep the oligarchy
in
power.
What we're talking about here is next month's election, really, isn't it?
Yes, and of course, what happens in various states in the US is it's all decided by the local officials, who are themselves under the pressure from local political forces to fix things one way or another.
Going back for
so
a
there's
minute.
Whole loads of people in the US. Very unlikely that more than 50% of the people will participate
going
in the
back
election.
To this,
most of people aren't on the electoral register. They could be registered. Everybody could be automatically registered, but they don't do that.
Going back to this Fox News versus Dominion voting suit, which led to the sacking of Tucker Carlson, Fox actually paid nearly $800 million to settle that defamation suit out of court to Dominion. So it was quite a serious move, wasn't it, by these people to make sure that their reputation is protected, and that I would maybe it's a good time to revisit that investigation.
Well, I mean, if Murdoch was confident,
it never came to court.
If
it was
Murdoch
settled out of
was
court.
Confident that they had stolen the election, he'd have gone to court.
Not necessarily.
Oh, he might have been he might have been paid off. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So, in other words, you know when John F. Kennedy won against Nixon in 1962.
When it comes to election fixing, Murdoch can be a bit tricksy, can't he?
In 1962, the state of Texas voted for JFK, which is where Lyndon Johnson was the big political boss, and everybody who knows anything about the history knows that they stuffed the ballot boxes, because that's what used to happen in Chicago, Texas, loads of places in the U.S. In fact, fraud in U.S. elections is as American as apple pie. And of course, Nixon was very bitter about losing that election, but of course he accepted, because he knew that if he fixed it the next time, then the other side would have to accept that. So what you've got in the US is people accept that the elections are stolen as long as they get their turn at the trough the next time. And that's been going on for a long time, and ultimately it led to a civil war in the country back in the 1860s. And that's the kind of country in the United States of America is. As I say, less than 50% of the population will vote in this election, because about at least a third of the electorate aren't registered to vote, and that's the way they like it. That's the poor people in the poor areas. And of course, they also make sure in places like Texas that if you want to vote, you'll have to queue up for 4 hours, whereas if you're in a posh part,
well, you can do a postal vote, can't you?
Well, that's what's changing it all, but what's happening now is postal votes and advanced voting is changing
I think Don DeBar's point the other week was absolutely brilliant, that the US elections don't even get to the standard that the State Department holds other countries where it's observing elections to.
No, it doesn't. And of course, what could happen if Trump wins, but he gets less than 50% of the vote, the people that want to stop the war in Gaza might have to go into the streets and say, we're not going to accept you as the president. Because that's what they demand, that's what they tried to do in Venezuela. And there was an immediate attempted uprising by the opposition, which led to various deaths because they went out fighting. You know, they weren't just protesting, and it was all put down. And then, you know, Maduro now it looks as if he's in there. They're not going to be able to get him out. Now, this is you know, in Latin America as a whole, these things are very much on a knife edge. The right and the left wing are very evenly balanced.
The FBI in the United States lost count of how many paid informants were at Capitol Hill on the 6th of January 2020, and later performed an audit to figure out the exact number. So the actual number apparently is 200 federal agents were there on Capitol Hill, which is pretty incredible, isn't it, if you think about it? But this report, which is being done by, there's a House Judiciary Committee that's looking into all of this, apparently, looking at the weaponization of the FBI in politics. They're not going to be delivering their report until after this election, at the end of November sometimes. So it does look as if, it's quite clear, there were lots and lots of FBI people involved in the 6th of January that it could quite possibly have stopped it if the FBI had been doing their job, or maybe they were instigating things.
They were probably of agent provocateurs. And of course, what happened on the day, and then we never heard anything about it, there were supposedly bombs left outside both the Democratic and Republican headquarters. I smell a rat there. This is the deep state messing around. But I come back to the further point, which I keep coming back to, and I know it bores you, but I think it's really important. Trump has never won 50% of the vote, nor have the Tories in this country. And in actual fact, neither of them would ever have been in power in any other Western Democratic country.
No.
But we just go,
no.
Oh, that's all right, that's
no,
how
we don't. We don't go, that's all right, Martin. Nobody does, only you. A long-awaited watchdog report on the Justice Department's handling of the January the 6th Capitol riot likely won't be released until after the presidential election in November, the department's Inspector General said this week during testimony to the Republican-led House Committee on alleged weaponized... Well, they say alleged, it's not. It's actually the committee itself is on the weaponization of the federal government. Inspector General Michael Horowitz said there is a draft of the report that's not yet ready to be released. I doubt it will be done in time for the election. Asked by Kentucky Republican Thomas Massel if the report would be complete before the inauguration on the 20th of January, he responded, that is certainly my hope. Now, we know the FBI get up to these sorts of things. We were discussing last week about our very own equivalent MI5 getting up to all sorts of tricks. Martin, the FBI and the MI5, it seems to me, are totally out of control and, in fact, steering many of these events. And it could even be that this whole January the 6th business was deliberate. In fact, there were gates which were left open, for example, on the Capitol building, so that they said it was an accident, so that the protesters could stream into the building and break into it.
Well, that's right. I mean, the FBI have always been the political police of the United States of America. J. Edgar Hoover was definitely involved in politics, and he was definitely involved in things like the assassination of Kennedy, probably. This is, you know, this is the United States as it's always been. It's not that it's turned into this. It's always been like this, and it's getting worse. And, of course, the right wing are now complaining because the FBI have been turned on them. They weren't complaining in the 1960s when they stitched up the whole of the Black Panthers, including the assassination of Fred Hampton, who was only 23 at the time.
Right, so just before the break, a little ode from Patrizia about Chris Cabba and that shooting. Two tier before Mowdown, she says. Two tiers, tis said, a new buzzword. Policing seen as quite absurd. Stir up feelings to the brim. Make folk feel that fairness trimmed to the bone. The chips are down. Policemen seen as hapless clowns. Cover-ups, where'er we look. Cabba trial. Come hook or crook. Shot to death, one-way story. No chance to learn his side, no glory. Dig deep undercover, the reason for. Young man in car, shot down, encore. Accusations streamed when death is done. Dead man mute, part of the run. To cover up where truth may live. But murder still on shooter give. A haunting taunting of blood and gore. Once murder foul on conscience war. No escape from what was done to Chris at barrel of a gun.
He took 100 pounds of clay, and then he said, "Hey, listen, I'm gonna fix this world today, because I know what's missing." Then he rolled his big sleeves up, and a brand new world began. He created a woman and lots of loving for a man. Whoa, yes he did. With just 100 pounds of clay, he made my life worth living, and I will thank him every day for every kiss you're giving, and I'll thank him every night for the arms that are holding me tight. And he did it all with just 100 pounds of clay. Yes, he did. Oh, yes, he did. Now can't you just see him walking around and round, picking the clay up off the ground, doing just what he should do to make a living dream like you. He rolled his big sleeves up, and a brand new world began. He created a woman and a lots of loving for a man. Whoa, yes he did, with just 100 pounds of clay.
I believe in God,
people,
the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, who was conceived by the Holy Ghost, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. The third day he rose again from the dead. He ascended into heaven, and sitteth on the right hand of God the Father Almighty. From thence he shall come to judge the quick and the dead. I believe in the Holy Ghost, the Holy Catholic Church, the communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body, and the life everlasting. Amen.
One time a crazy dream came to me. I dreamt I was walking to World War III. I went to the doctor the very next day to see what kind of things he had to say. He said it was a terrible dream. I said, "Hold it, Doc, a world war passed through my brain." He said, "Nurse, get your pad, the boy's obviously insane." He grabbed my arm and I said, "Ouch," as I landed on the psychiatric couch. He said, "Tell me all about it." Well, the whole thing started at 3 o'clock fast. It was all over by 1:15. I was down in the sewer with some little lover when I peeked out from a manhole cover, wondering who turned the lights on. Well, I got up and I walked around, up and down the lonesome town, just wondering which way to go. I lit a cigarette on a parking meter and walked on down the road. It was a normal day. Down the corner by the hot dog stand, I saw a man. I said, "Howdy, friend, I guess it's just us two." He screamed, down the road he flew. He thought it was a communist. Well, I remember reading some newspaper ads, so I turned on McConnell Rad. I bet it didn't pay the Con Ed bill, so the radio didn't work so well. I turned on my record player. It was Donovan. Whoever Donovan is. I spied a girl before she could leave. I say, let's go play Adam and Eve. I take her by the heart and my hand was thumping. She said, hey man, are you crazy or something? You saw what happened last time they started. By that time I was feeling blue and needed somebody to talk to. So I called up the operator of time just to hear a voice of some kind. She said, when you hear the beep, it will be 3 o'clock. She said that for a couple days and then I hung up. Well, the doctor interrupted me just about then, saying, I've been having the same old dream, but mine's different, don't you see? I dreamt the only person left after the war was me. I didn't see no one that looked like you around. Time passed and now it seems everybody's having those dreams. Everybody sees herself walking around with nobody else. Well, half the people can be all right part of the time. All of the people can be part right some of the time. Some of the people can be half right all of the time. But all of the people can't be all right all of the time. Robert Frost said that. I'll let you be in my dream if I can be in your dream. I said that.
The first to arrive were the cameras installed to protect both you and me in places that we weren't that threatened, and yet people didn't see. And what followed were traffic restrictions to keep the roads quiet and clean. The maths didn't add up, nor the science, but still, the people didn't see. And next came the 15-minute neighbourhoods, to make our lives easier, decreed. To some, it seemed like restrictions, but still, the people didn't see. And then came the digital ID, so convenient, easy, and free. Your life in one chip on a mainframe, and still, the people didn't see. The cars they sold were electric, all wired to the government PC. And they switched off the driving on Sundays, and still, the people didn't see. And the banks moved their money to digital, and the government banned cash the next week, and the ability to fly was restricted, and still, the people didn't see. They linked up your money and profile to the ID on the government PC, and connected it to social media, and still, the people didn't see. And then came a new cure, a new virus, safe and effective, and free. They linked these jabs to your profile and connected the government PC. And when the people were locked in their cities, policed by their digital ID, unable to visit their loved ones, now, finally, the people can see. Restricted and tracked with no money. To go further, a permit you'll need. Contained in your digital city. Oh, why did the people not see? These steps they've sold us as progress never looked to be quite what they seemed. And if you don't ask the questions in protest, then your children will never know. Free.
Now Delaney had a donkey that everyone admired. Temporarily lazy and permanently tired. A leg at every corner, balance in his head. And a tail to let you know which end he wanted to be fed. Riley slyly said, we've underrated it. Why not train it? Then they took a rag. They rubbed it, scrubbed it, they oiled and imbricated it. Got it at the post and when the starter dropped the flag. There was Riley pushing it, shoving it, shushing it. Hogan
Logan and everyone in town. Lined up attacking it and shoving it and smacking it, they might as well try to push the town hall down. The donkey was eyeing them, openly defying them, winking, blinking and twisting out of place. Riley reversing it, everybody cursing it, the day Delaney's donkey ran the half-mile race. The muscles of the mighty never known to flinch, they couldn't move the donkey a quarter of an inch. Delaney lay exhausted, hanging round his throat, with a grip just like a Scotsman on the £5 note. Starter Carter, he lined it with the rest of them. When it saw them, it was willing then. It raced up, braced up, ready for the best of them. They started off to cheer it, but it changed its mind again. And there was Riley, pushing it, shoving it, shushing it, Hogan, Logan and Mary Ann McGrath. She started poking it and grabbing it and choking it. It kicked her in the bustle and it laughed, hee-ha. The Whigs and Conservatives, the radical superlatives, Liberals and Tories, they hurried to the place. Stood there in unity, helping the community, the day Delaney's donkey ran the half-mile race. The crowd began to cheer it, and Rafferty, the judge, he came up to assist him, but still it wouldn't budge. And the jockey who was riding it, little John McGee, was so thoroughly disgusted that he went and had his tea. Hagen, Fagin were students of psychology, swore they'd shift him with some dynamite. They bought it, brought it, and without apology, the donkey gave a sneeze and blew the whole lot out of sight. And there was Riley, pushing it, shoving it, shushing it, Hogan, Logan, and all the bally crew. Police and auxiliary, the garrison artillery, the second in the skillings and the lifeguards too. They seized it and harried it, they picked it up and carried it, cheered it, steered it to the winning place. Then the bookmakers drew aside, and they all committed suicide. The day Delaney's donkey won the half-mile race.
So that's Val Doonigan finishing off. It's a bit cheeky putting that in there. Well, that's the sort of stuff we don't hear anymore. Great, jolly, fun stuff. From all that was from the 1960s, that last one, as well as Val Doonigan and Delaney's Donkey. And before that, we had Bob Dylan in England recording here at a live concert in 1965. That was a talking World War III blues, quite appropriate, of course. And before that, at the beginning of that, we had 100 Pounds of Clay by Gene McDaniels from 1961. And sandwiched in the middle is a guy called Lewis Holmes talking about surveillance. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We have a serious note, starting on a serious note, right, because we're going to be hearing direct from northern Gaza tonight from various correspondents. Obviously, the Israelis have been trying to kill anybody that's telling you what's going on there, preventing Al Jazeera, people like that, getting their story out at all. This is something which we will pick up on after we've heard from northern Gaza. Martin, this is a pretty serious situation, isn't it? The Israelis have now basically told everybody in the area they've got to get out or they're going to be killed. They're not going to be taken prisoner. They're just going to be shot dead.
Yeah, it's the so-called general's plan. Put forward by a general, I can't remember his name.
No now. Aid has been allowed in for the last nearly 3 weeks now.
No, and I think what's happening is the people in northern Gaza are refusing to move because they realise that even if they go to the south, they're not going to survive. They're not going to go, which means the Israelis are going to kill them all, of course.
So we'll start is a special report for this programme from northern Gaza by Rawan. That's all we'll say about her. Funny, isn't it, that they're not getting men reporting because the men have all been rounded up pretty much now.
Yeah, well, they're in the tunnels.
So let's hear from northern Gaza now.
Hello, I'm Rawan from North Gaza. The situation here is catastrophic in every sense of the word. With the ongoing genocide, displacement and siege, the occupation has forced the people of northern Gaza displaced under the threat of artillery, tank and drone attacks. It killed more than 770 Palestinians. bombed hospitals and shelters, prevented the entry of aid for 19 days to force the people of northern Gaza to be displaced. Those who do not leave their homes and shelters are killed in cold blood. All adult males are arrested. Women and children are left to walk long distance alone in search of a new shelter. It's a new Nakba in 2024. Stop genocide against the people of northern Gaza. Reporting by Rawan, North Gaza.
So that's Brave Rowan telling us what's going on. She also sent me a little bit of text to describe what's going on. That is, the situation here, she said, is catastrophic in every sense of the word. The ongoing genocide, displacement and siege. The Israeli occupation has forced the people of northern Gaza to be displaced under the threat of artillery, tank and drone attacks. The Israeli occupation army has killed more than 770 martyrs, injured more than 1,000, has left dozens missing in Jabalia camp town and their surroundings in 19 days, and forces thousands of civilians under threat of death to be forcibly displaced from their homes and residential neighbourhoods in the northern Gaza Strip. It bombed homes, hospitals and shelters. Civil defence spokesman Mahmoud Bassal said, "We regret to announce that we are unable to provide humanitarian service to the citizens in North Gaza anymore due to Israeli occupation forces threatening to kill and shell our teams if they remain inside Jabalia refugee camp. Several team members have been targeted and injured, and others lying on the streets bleeding with no one able to rescue them. Desalination and water pumping stations in the north have completely stopped due to lack of fuel. No aid trucks have entered in weeks due to the occupation siege, causing a total collapse of civilian infrastructure. Around 400,000 people will be left without water unless fuel and aid are allowed in immediately. Those who do not leave their homes and shelters are killed in cold blood. All adult males have been arrested. Women and children are left to walk long distances alone in search of new shelter. It's a new Nakba," she says, "in 2024. Stop the genocide against the people of northern Gaza." Reporting by Rowan in North Gaza. So that's a sort of longer version of what she said there, but it's incredible to hear her voice, Martin, trembling, actually.
It is, and one's almost speechless when you hear all of these things. Did you see that Keir Starmer this week said that Russian attacks on the port in Odessa are preventing grain from going into Gaza? Which I thought, that is a really, really, you know, talk about adding insult to injury. So, you see, you know, the reason why the people in Gaza are starving, Tony? It's because of Putin. Putin's starving them. According to our Prime Minister.
I think not, yeah. Amazing, isn't it, the audacity of these people to twist and lie. I mean, audacity is not the right word. They're war criminals. So she also adds, if you'd like to help us, I hope you can donate what you can and publish my PayPal account. Perhaps someone will donate to us. It helps my family and other displaced families in our homes to get food and necessities of life. Please donate via PayPal. And it's paypal.me/rasmy, RASMY 1998. That's RASMY 1998. So I'll put a link up to that on our show page, also at thisweek.org.uk. Although one does wonder, you know, what can money do if there's simply no food around? I suppose some people may be hoarding a little bit of food, and people like Rowan has to buy it from them.
Well, if she's made that request, I think it's, you know, it's because she thinks she can use it. So
I mean, one does wonder, because people might think, oh, I want to donate to aid agencies, but the aid agencies can't get any food through to them.
That's okay. Well, I mean, in any case, I mean, she's obviously risking her life by making this these calls to people like yourself. And, you know, in normal circumstances, you would pay people for journalistic work.
Well, that one is specifically for the show. Here is a more generic one, which was sent to Bristol journalists more generally. And this is from Bissan.
Hi, everyone. It's night. You know, people normally sleep during this time. But in our case, Gazans, we get murdered in a cold blood. 30 minutes ago, only 30 minutes, the first picture of the last Jabalia massacre reached the media. After 3 hours of committing the massacre, the Israeli army intentionally bombed and destroyed 11 to 13 residential buildings full of people in Block 7 Jabalia refugee camp. So 150 to 200 people so far, I mean known, have been killed or severely injured. What will happen to the injured people? There's no ambulance reaching there, no firemen to stop the fire from eating the bodies of the injured and the children, no civil defense to grab the people from under the rubble, nothing, even journalists, no one to cover this massacre. Why? Because the Israeli army yesterday bombed and destroyed the last civil defense vehicle after kidnapping, actually, the whole staff a day before. Why is this happening? Because the Israeli army is besieging Jabalia and Beit Lahia and the hospital in between them, which is Kamal Adwan. And if you ask me what I am expecting from sending this message and what we are expecting as people in Gaza from telling you what is happening, I'll answer that I'm not expecting anything, actually, because this genocide has been on for more than a year, but the genocide inside the genocide, which is happening now in the north of Gaza Strip, in Jabalia, Beit Lahia, and Beit Hanun, is happening for 20 days now, and no one is moving. I feel and I believe that the world actually is complicit in this, is silent in this. No one must be silent in this. Jabalia and people in the north in general have been annihilated in the most brutal ways ever. I mean, only in the last 3 days, only in the last 3 days, we've watched together evacuating the areas, killing people, torturing them, kidnapping them to unknown areas, children and men, separating men from women, injuring people and killing people, and evacuating the hospitals and schools by bombing either the entrances of hospitals or even whole floors like what happened in Kamal Adwan, or bombing the schools like what happened in the Hussein, Fouga, Hamad, and other schools. And after evacuating the people who survived the bombing, they burn the school and the hospitals, so people are not returning to the north again. This place forever. I've been watching people walking on death lines, carrying their ID cards, taken, tortured, killed, button into a hole without knowing until now what happened to them after 2 days of the news. Like several eyewitnesses, people saw what happened. No journalists, of course, no footage for burying people alive and putting them into a hole, like, shooting at them. I don't know what must happen for you to move. I don't know. But I know that you know where is Gaza. And I believe that it's now or never. You need to move. You need to move. March. March from the entire world. March to Gaza and to the Palestinian borders. It's time to do anything on the ground besides protesting, besides demonstrations. Israel is not afraid of your protests. We're not afraid enough to stop all of this madness. Yesterday I watched a video of a woman who lost her 10 sons and daughters evacuating alone, fleeing. I saw a woman holding like 2 hours newborn saying that his mother was killed by the Israeli army while giving birth to this little child while she was in an ambulance vehicle. An ambulance. This can't be real. And this can't be the world that you want to live in and put your family in. Can't be. This must stop. Khalas, 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 khalas. 2 days ago, 87 people killed in Beit Lahia, and now 200 in Jabalia. So, what next? What next? Waiting for the 2 million to be killed, so no one is making headache to you? What next? What next?
So that's Bissan speaking to Bristol journalists generally, and the hope that someone will get it out there, as we've just done. And Martin, the atmosphere here, of course, is even in, over there, although the Palestinians appreciate people going out marching, they're saying it's not enough, it's not changed it. It's not changed the situation for them. And things are getting extremely desperate, where they are starving. And literally none of the basics that they need to live are there anymore. Buildings being deliberately destroyed so that actually no human being can live in that area.
Well, I know she said that demonstrations aren't enough, but I've just remembered there is a demonstration in Bristol tomorrow, assembling on College Green from 11:30, marching to Castle Park. But just because it's not enough doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. I intend to be there. I don't know if you've seen the other story this week about the CNN ran this story about an Israeli bulldozer driver who'd committed suicide because of his bad experiences in Gaza. And he'd actually made videos of himself, driving his bulldozer and bulldozing things in Gaza. And apparently his friend who committed said, well, he said he couldn't eat meat because he'd seen so many live and dead bodies being crushed by his bulldozer that he couldn't eat meat anymore. And then he committed suicide. And this was all being presented in CNN as poor Israeli soldiers. They're so, upset about what they've done that they're committing suicide. But in actual fact, the guy's been actually carrying out war crimes. So maybe he's better off dead, eh?
Or maybe it was suicide. I just don't trust anything that the Israelis say anymore. The Guardian, by the way, you talking of that, had an article last week. The tales of infanticide have stoked hatred of Jews for centuries. They echo still today.
That's Howard Jacobson
in The Guardian, yeah. A year after the 7th of October attacks, the myth of the blood libel persists in the media coverage of Gaza violence, he says. Jews habitually murdered Gentile children for blood with which to make Passover matzo. It was a popular superstition throughout Britain and Europe. In the Middle Ages, these fictions cost many innocent Jews their lives, he says.
Yes, and it's totally irrelevant to what's going on in Gaza. Nobody is... No Israeli soldiers are killing children in order to take their blood to eat matzos, are they? They're killing them because they're Palestinians and they want the land. And the evidence has come up from people who, doctors who've been working in Gaza, they sent it all to Biden. They're shooting toddlers. Snipers are shooting toddlers. They're drawing a bead on their head and shooting them through the heart and through the head. It's a deliberate policy of killing children, because of course they're all going to grow up to be terrorists, and of course probably they are going to grow up for the freedom of their country.
It does make you wonder. I mean, we looked at this last week, this business of Maimonides, and I think, I get frustrated, like I did, I suppose when I was growing up I thought, oh, this Hitler was a crazy guy. He's not a crazy guy. He has a specific mission. He has beliefs that he's trying to fulfill, and exactly the same is true with Netanyahu. As has been pointed out by several people, this guy Maimonides, he wrote a book called Misneh, I don't know how you pronounce that, Mishneh, The Law of Kings, back in 1180, when he was living in Egypt, this Jewish rabbi. And he says the Messianic king will arise in the future and restore the Davidic kingdom to its former state and original sovereignty. He will build the temple and gather the dispersed of Israel. All the laws will be reinstituted in his days as they had been aforetimes. Sacrifices will be offered, and the sabbatical years and jubilee years will be fully observed as ordained by the Torah. Now, the suggestion is that, in fact, with the modern day rabbis chit-chatting with Netanyahu, such as the Lubavitcher rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, as he was chatting to Netanyahu in 1990, saying, so do something to hasten the Messiah's coming. So isn't this simply what Netanyahu's up to, Martin? He thinks it's his job to create the chaos so that the Jewish Messiah can arrive on the scene and sort everything out and be hailed as such.
I think Netanyahu himself is not that religious, but he's dependent upon religious Jews. Yes, of course he has to talk to those people. Yeah. That doesn't mean that he is in... I mean, I don't see Netanyahu, don't forget, he's got a very strong vested interest in keeping this war going, otherwise he might end up in prison.
And is it convenient for him to believe these things about himself?
Yes. Yes, well, it's convenient for him. He was the one who mentioned about the Amalek
t-shirt.
And so on.
Yeah, I've got this T-shirt on saying, I want to believe, with a picture of a flying saucer.
Well, yes, but of course people
do want to believe things because they're convenient. And particularly for Netanyahu, who's rather hemmed in by the fact that as soon as he's out of power, he'd probably be jailed.
That's right. But I think people like Smotrich and
Ben-Gavir,
they really are religious fanatics. Netanyahu's just a very, very nasty piece of work. I think he's quite a cynical person, actually. I don't think he cares much about anybody but himself.
And there's a lot of annoyance about this Howard Jacobson article amongst Jews in London, particularly.
Well, it's just an outrageous thing to do, because the picture on the top of it had a picture of somebody with a doll with blood on it, suggesting that that in actual fact no children have been killed at all, and it's all a libel against the Israeli Defence Forces. But we've got evidence from outsiders who are not Palestinian that the snipers have been shooting toddlers. And, of course, it turned out that 40 babies weren't beheaded by Hamas.
And so
there were no babies killed at all on October the 7th.
Bless him. Tony Greenstein put together a letter, as he's about to tell us, to The Guardian about this Howard Jacobson article, saying, look, this is just appalling, you should apologise for it, or whatever, and they say it's not historically accurate at all. But The Guardian refused to publish it, so of course Tony Greenstein's published it on his blog. But anyway, I spoke to Tony Greenstein, sorry about the slightly dodgy quality of this, but I hope you can hear it all right, as he explains why he feels so strongly about people like Howard Jacobson being published in The Guardian, talking about this terrible blood libel of Jews, but not the response by the Jewish community.
My name is Tony Greenstein. I'm a long-standing Jewish activist, the first Jewish member of the Labour Party to be expelled as part of the anti-Semitism smear campaign. Just very simply, Pat Viner, who is the editor of The Guardian, an overall in charge of Guardian Observer, ran a couple of weeks ago a piece by Howard Jacobs basically saying that media coverage of the death of thousands of Palestinian children was nothing more than a blood libel. For those who are not aware of it, it was the myth in the Middle Ages that Jews slaughtered or killed non-Jewish children so they could make their unleavened bread in the blood of those children, which of course was a total myth. However, the death of Palestinian children is not a myth, it's a fact, it's a reality. And to run this libelous article, which had no merit whatsoever, I just think is outrageous. I sent in a letter with over 1,000 signatories and it was ignored. How Mike Rose sent in a letter, it was ignored. There was a couple of letters, but we know there was a massive reaction because they had his ex-publisher writing an article which was pretty useless, but there you go. But this is part of the genocide justification. The Guardian has been foremost in this. It's refused to see it for what it is, which is mass ethnic cleansing and extermination now, in essence, in the north of Gaza.
How is this? Everyone is saying, really, the Americans, Blinken's over there again, the 11th time, I think. How is this going to end, do you think, Tony?
Well, it's ending very badly. I mean, the North has been declared, in essence, a free fire zone. You're having death marches, for anyone who doesn't remember. When the Nazis closed concentration camps, the inmates were forced on death marches, and that's exactly what's happening in Gaza. Zionism is replicating the Jews' historical enemies. What's happening in Gaza is a Holocaust. You must be bloody clear about that. Maybe 200,000 to 300,000 have died and are dying. Food hasn't been let in for 3 weeks. And yet the Americans are giving them 30 days, or they might just think about cutting off a few arms. I mean, the international legal system has collapsed. It's shown to be totally ineffective because of the American imperialism. So that's the story. There is actually no international law when it comes to it, because the courts will not enforce it. They can't enforce it. In the case of the International Criminal Court, they have outstanding application for warrants against Yoav Gallant and Netanyahu. The courts just sat on it. It's paralysed. It's useless. So we can see that all of the legal architecture put into place after the Holocaust of the Nazis been shown to be totally
and utterly
redundant.
So, Tony Greenstein speaking to me. Sorry about the quality of the sound there. He had a very, very short time window. He's off to Holland. It's all sorts of interesting things he's throwing in there, Martin. Fascinating as ever, particularly about Mike Rosen and him trying to get stuff into The Guardian. Instead, The Guardian editor, Kath Viner, I'm not sure what should be done with her, but she certainly shouldn't be editing a newspaper. She should probably be put on trial for complicity with genocide, has asked Michael Rosen's publisher to write a critical piece instead of the people who are actually Jews in London who are writing things critical of Howard Jacobson's piece. So the death marches as well, what's that? Do you know?
As the Russians were closing in on the Eastern Front, some concentration camps, they rounded up the inmates that were still alive, and they made them march in retreat with the German army. But of course, these were death marches. Anybody who fell behind was shot, what have you. It's just another version. You know, it's just one of the ways in which people are, mistreated and
200,000 dead or dying. He's also saying that there is no law. It's quite obvious now. International law is a complete waste of time.
Well, I can see why he's saying that. But on the other hand...
Well, it's not just him saying it, is it? It's the people in Gaza, too.
Yes, they are saying it. But the fact that the international courts have decided that there's something the matter here is a victory. Of course, it's a very small comfort to the people in Gaza.
What we were hearing from Bissan earlier on was that the Israelis don't care. They're just going to carry on regardless anyway.
They probably are. But once they've lost World War III, they may be facing trials. That is definitely, and of course, those who are complicit in this country may be facing trials. You've got to, justice goes to the
victims. What we're worried about is the situation for 400,000 people in northern Gaza right now. Never mind, however many long it is in some possible Nuremberg in the long distant future.
Well, I totally agree with you, Tony. Now, what should we do then to help them? I'm intending to demonstrate tomorrow. Are you coming?
Well, Bissan has said it's pointless.
Can I say it's not pointless? We're going to do what we can do. And that's all we can do for now. What we really need is the Iranians to destroy the Israeli army and the Russians to pile in.
Well, isn't that exactly what the Israelis want?
No, it's not.
Because they know that would start World War III, and that's actually what they want.
Well, in that case, the British and the Americans should keep their nose out of it, otherwise their soldiers should be killed.
Okay, here's a few suggestions then about what to do. First of all, airdrop food into northern Gaza, airdrop water in.
Who's going to do that?
Anybody can.
The Israelis won't let the British drop stuff in. The British can fly in.
Well, Actually, any reasonably brave pilot from any air force with a Hercules aircraft can be dropping stuff. We've already seen this going on, at least to make sure that these people are not starving to death as they're driven out of northern Gaza.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen, Tony.
How about blowing up the wall? How about some squads of soldiers going along and destroying
the
wall?
How about the
so that people can actually get out rather than this being a prison camp?
How about the RAF bombing the Israelis like we did the Serbs? They're based in Akrotiri there. It's quite a short trip. They could be bombing Israeli forces as they go into Gaza. Knock out the tanks. Go for their command and control. Take down their air defence. The Russians are in Syria. They could take down the Israeli air defence. But then they'd have to run up against the RAF and the United States.
So isn't this whole BRICS business a bit of a paper tiger?
Well, it is in terms of rescuing people in Gaza, but of course there's about to be possibly a nuclear bomb dropped on Iran. What are we going to do about that? Yeah? It's no use getting... there is no easy solution to this, Tony.
No, I didn't say that, did I?
Well, yeah,
I said it's, you know, some action surely needs to be taken to save lives of people in the in northern Gaza.
Well, you remind me of people when I used to go off to Bosnia during the Bosnian War. People say, well, can't all the children be evacuated like they were in Britain during the war?
Well, I didn't
can't
say that, did I?
No,
I used two examples. Well, one is getting food and water to them. The other is blowing up this wall so that people can actually get out.
All right, well, they could have been let into Egypt, but the Egyptians didn't want them to come in because then they'd have to accept them as refugees, and then they wouldn't be able to go back to Gaza and take it over. The people in northern Gaza have been told to leave to southern Gaza, and they're refusing to go because they know they'll get killed in southern Gaza. They're from northern Gaza. This is where I was born. This is where I'm going to die. And of course, their boys are still underneath them in the tunnels, and they're coming up, and they are killing Israeli soldiers. They knocked out a couple of tanks yesterday, and the fight goes on, and it's going to go on until the Israeli army is destroyed in World War III, and that will happen, but it won't be done by a few airdrops by people. It's actually going to require hypersonic missiles, possibly fired from Russia.
You prefer hypersonic missiles to food drops, do you?
Yep. I do, Tony.
Okay, well, we can agree to differ on that. Anyway,
You don't want any hypersonic missiles.
One thing that one person that did have something to say about all this last weekend at the big demonstration in London was Alexei Sale, who read out this poem.
I'm going to read a poem by James Baldwin. He wrote it at the time of the Vietnam War. Sadly, James Baldwin's poem is as relevant now as it was when it was written. It is called Every Bombed Village is My Hometown. And every dead child is my child. And every grieving mother is my mother. Every grandfather is my father. Every home turned to rubble is the home that I grew up in. Every brother carrying the remains of his brother across borders is my brother. Every sister waiting for a sister who will never come home is my sister. Every one of these people are ours. Just like we are theirs. We belong to them and they belong to us.
So that's Alexei Sale's answer, Martin. What do you say to that?
Well, he's just saying we're on their side. And he's protesting, which is what I intend to do tomorrow.
Okay, good. Well, excellent. There's also a lot of concern at the moment about the number of journalists being killed, more than anywhere else, apparently. Al Jazeera had a piece on it just earlier last night, although, of course, we're not allowed to watch that on Freeview anymore. You've got to plug yourself into the internet if you want to watch Al Jazeera now. That happened just exactly the same week as the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. So let's have a listen now to this chap. He's called Usman Noor, Usmannor, and here he explains a little bit about the journalistic problems. In fact, I think this was somewhere at the UN or the EU where he gave this. No, hang on, maybe it was in Switzerland where he gave this speech. The UN in Switzerland and Geneva. So let's have a listen now to him. He's an international human rights lawyer, and he had this to say.
The effort to prevent journalistic coverage has been guided by government policy in the USA and Israel. In 1988, during the first Intifada, when Palestinians organized peaceful protests against the long-standing occupation of their land through boycotts and refusal to work, they were met with a brutal response from the occupying power, including mass arrests, arbitrary detention, and violent repression of those protesting. During this time, a photo emerged of a 17-year-old boy with a stone in his hand being beaten by two Israeli soldiers, with one of them breaking the boy's arm with the back of a rifle. This image appeared in the US press, who were alarmed by the egregious power disparity between the armed soldiers beating this boy into submission and the now popularized depiction of the Palestinians as children with stones versus Israeli soldiers with tanks was born. In January of that year, Henry Kissinger held an audience with leading figures of the Israeli lobby in the United States, and a memorandum of that meeting was leaked. What he says in that meeting is extremely telling, because his chief concern was not that Israel was committing these brutalities, but frustration at the fact that it had been revealed. He urges Israeli leaders to, quote, throw out the press and ban television from the trouble spots a la South Africa, referring to the repression of journalistic freedom under the apartheid South African regime in the 1980s. And he also suggests that the Israeli army should be sent to put down the insurrection, quote, overwhelmingly, brutally, and rapidly, end quote. So in the face of peaceful resistance from Palestinian people during the first Intifada, seeking to achieve their right to self-determination and live free from unlawful occupation, the response was to ensure that the press don't cover the story and be ready to shoot those involved. In 2022, this is what they did to Shirin Abu Akleh. While reporting on an Israeli military raid in the West Bank of city of Jenin, Shirin was shot and killed by an Israeli sniper. She was a Palestinian-American journalist who worked for Al Jazeera for over 25 years and was a deeply respected voice in the struggles faced by Palestinians. Despite wearing a press vest and helmet, clearly identifying her as a journalist, eyewitnesses and multiple investigations, including one by the United Nations, indicated that she was shot by Israeli forces. This targeting and killing of journalists and reporting on the atrocities committed by Israel has been a hallmark of the current genocide. In the last year, there have been over 130 journalists killed, the highest number in any modern conflict, with Israel preventing reporters from entering Gaza and even closing down entire TV stations in Israel and the occupied West Bank. Why is Israel doing this? Jonathan Dager, head of the Reporters Without Borders Middle East desks, explained, "If there are no journalists, there's no one who can independently verify and tell the world that then the Israeli army becomes the source of information," end quote. The goal is to remove the storytellers and deny the truth. This repression of journalism is not limited to those reporting from the ground, but also to those reporting from around the world. Over the last few months, the UK government has been engaging in alarming and intensified levels of repression against activists, including artists, journalists, and academics. To give a few examples, on the morning of the 16th of October, counter-terrorism police in Glasgow Airport detained journalist, whistleblower, human rights campaigner, and former British diplomat Craig Murray upon his return from Iceland. In August 2024, freelance journalist Richard Medhurst was detained and questioned by police at Heathrow Airport. Medhurst said he believed he was targeted for speaking out on the situation in Palestine and in fact spoke at the UN here in Geneva recently about the detention. Just a few weeks later, another journalist and activist, Sarah Wilkinson, saw her home raided in the early hours of the morning. Personal items were confiscated, but to date, she has not been charged. This week, 10 counter-terrorism police officers raided the London home of the prominent journalist Asa Winstanley, who eventually was neither arrested nor charged with any offence, but his electronic devices were confiscated by the police. And this month, the General Secretaries of the UK's National Union of Journalists and the International Federation of Journalists wrote to the head of counter-terrorism policing in the UK to raise concerns about the use of counter-terrorism powers against journalists covering Gaza. So while Israel kills journalists reporting on the ground in Gaza, Western governments silence, repress, and criminalise those reporting on this reality.
Yes, that's Usman Noor. Fascinating. In fact, I tried to find him on LinkedIn, and it kept saying, oh, there's been some sort of error, because he'd just put an article up on there. I could see it on one of the search engines, but as I clicked through to LinkedIn, it kept giving me an error. Anyway, the point here, Martin, I suppose, is pretty it's pretty obvious. There's been more journalists killed here than ever before. There's been no sort of conflict where the whole, you know, the idea that any kind of evidence is going to get out is part of the game. It seems to me the media is almost more important in a way than the land grab that's going on in Gaza.
Well, they've also been killing journalists in Lebanon. So they've been targeting Lebanese journalists as well.
The UN in Lebanon have been killed today.
Yes. You can see why they're doing it. So they don't want the stuff to get out there. But the problem they've got is that they've still got access to smartphones, and people can use the smartphones to get onto social media.
This is where BBC and the mainstream media come in, because they try to sort of steer away from... I mean, an Israeli airstrike today targeted Al Mayadeen's office in Beirut. The Israeli occupation forces launched an airstrike, targeted an office for Al Mayadeen in the Jannah locality in the Lebanese capital of Beirut. Wednesday evening, the occupation forces... they had to evacuate. The channel had evacuated the premises at the onset of the aggression. They held the Israeli occupation accountable for the assault on a well-known media outlet. This is a Lebanese channel. I've been on there. George Galloway's on there quite a bit.
Yeah, well, it's because it's Hezbollah's TV channel, I believe. So, yes, I mean, what they're doing is in Lebanon is they've carried out exactly the same tactics as they pursued in Gaza. And, of course, the West has basically been encouraging them, saying, well, as long as... They cheered for the killing of Sinwar, they cheered for the killing of Nasrallah, even though hundreds of civilians died. Sinwar died on his own, but hundreds of civilians were killed when Nasrallah was killed. And the Americans and the British, well, they... You know, Hezbollah and Hamas have been named by our Tory government as terrorists, and therefore it's okay for the Israelis to kill them however many civilians they kill while they're doing it. Although, in actual fact, Hamas won the democratic election in 2006 in all of Palestine, and Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government and is one of the biggest, it's the biggest political party in Lebanon. But of course, they are terrorists, and therefore they're allowed to be killing them. You know, never mind Chris Cabba being shot whether he had a gun or not, they're just trying to kill everybody associated with the party, which basically is all Shia in Lebanon.
And also killing, we hear today, they're also killing individuals from the UN peacekeeping forces. They've been Israeli tanks in Gaza are shelling Kamal Adwan Hospital. Netanyahu's allies are demanding military pressure over the revival of talks. Israel strikes have killed 55 more Palestinians in the Gaza Strip today. The US aid deadline for Israel is a PR ploy, says a former official. What do you think about that, this Gaza aid deadline after the US presidential election?
What they're doing is they're trying to get votes for Kamala Harris. So they've tried to say, well, we've sent a strong message to the Israelis that if they don't do something within 30 days, we don't know what we might do. But of course, that 30 days means it's after the election. So what they're hoping is that some people will hold their noses and vote for Kamala Harris on the understanding that, you know, there will be some kind of criticism of the Israelis, just you wait and see, we're going to tell them. But it's quite clear that that's not what's been going on. They could have at any time picked up the phone, as Ronald Reagan did in 1982, and said, stop this, or we're going to cut off your money. You know, you're grounded. But they haven't done that, and nor have the British.
Approximately 3 hours prior to the Hamas attack in southern Israel on the 7th of October, Shin Bet warned other elements of the police and security establishment that an assault emanating from the besieged Gaza Strip could be imminent. The Cannes public broadcaster and Channel 12 News reported the Internal Security Service sent a top-secret notification to the National Security Council, Mossad, and to the police that Israeli SIM cards Shin Bet had previously circulated within the group's ranks and Israeli SIM cards. Shin Bet had previously circulated within the group ranks as part of an operation, had been activated in a number of Hamas battalions. There was no solid quantification of how many SIM cards were activated in the warning, but as the Times of Israel notes, each battalion presumably contains hundreds of fighters. The operation involving the cards was launched to provide an early warning for future Hamas attacks against Israel. The generated alert was sent to situation rooms staff 24 hours a day, contradicting past police claims about never having received any warning.
Well, I mean, we discussed this at the time. It's quite clear...
Not this particular warning.
But no, not that particular
warning. There are quite a few warnings.
That's right. So in other words, what they did is they allowed it to happen. A lot of the military had been sent away to the West Bank, because it was a Yom Kippur holiday, they allowed the Nova rave to move to where it was so that all these people would be in the way when Hamas came out of the concentration camp, which is what it is. And therefore, and then they killed loads and loads of their own people with helicopter gunships so that they could claim that Hamas had killed, hundreds and hundreds of people. But it's actually quite clearly mostly killed by the Israelis killing their own people. The whole thing was set up by the Israelis so that they could then carry out the ethnic cleansing that they're doing, get what they want, take over Gaza. It looks like they're pushing for taking over a large chunk of Lebanon, although in actual fact, of course, as Hezbollah have pointed out, the Israeli settlers in the north of Lebanon are never coming back unless they do a deal with the Palestinians, in which case the state of Israel starts to shrink. And just wait till the hypersonic missiles come in from Iran, or possibly from Siberia.
More collateral damage. Yesterday, Israel accidentally, apparently, killed three Lebanese soldiers who were evacuating a South Lebanon village. The Pentagon expressed its deep concern, Martin.
Well, that's right, because the Lebanese army is trained by the Americans, and they won't give them any weaponry because they don't want them to be able to stand up to the Israelis. But that means, in fact, that they can't do anything about Hezbollah either.
They were facilitating an evacuation of wounded people from the village when an airstrike hit a house. An unspecified number of paramedics were wounded. A second strike then hit them when they were trying to rescue survivors.
Yeah, I think what they've done here is...
I mean, can someone not take out the Israeli Air Force?
Yes. That's just exactly what I've been saying to you. It could, if the British and the Americans weren't supporting the Israelis, the Syrians, the Russians and the Iranians could take out their air force and take out their army. Don't forget the Russians have crushed a whole Ukrainian army over the last 3 years. They've killed nearly 750,000 of them. The Israeli army isn't as big as that. And if they started firing hypersonic missiles at them, which they haven't got, they could knock them all out. They should go for military targets and kill as many Israeli soldiers as possible. Make their children cry. But don't kill their children, just the soldiers. Loads of them. Thousands. Tens of thousands.
Okay. Let's just sort of wind up by giving the last audio clip on the situation in the Middle East to Moeen Yassin. It's an interview I recorded with him a month or so ago, but he's got, I think, an excellent take, an interesting take here on Gaza and how this whole war is spun.
Even the so-called experts on Middle East studies do not talk about it because we're entering a different, dimension. As I mentioned, spiritual warfare. They don't want to go down that direction, or very few of them. But what I'm prepared to say is the following, and it makes sense to what I said about the four actors or dimensions to end times. Firstly, your question was what is happening in Israel or that region, with the boundaries, etc. Well, what I would like to say is that it's quite clear that we're talking about almost, 365 days, almost October 7, almost, that what we're seeing is not just a war, it's a genocidal war. People in the ICJ are still talking about intent and trying to clarify it, but the bottom line is I'm not a jurist, but I can see. I've got eyes. I'm not deaf, dumb, and blind, as the Quran says. So what we've got is a genocidal war of extermination of not Hamas. Why on earth are the Israelis now going all out for the West Bank? Hamas isn't in control there, and they're repeating the whole thing again. So basically what we've got is a genocidal war of extermination of what I call Philistine, the Arabic term for occupied Palestine, in Gaza, the West Bank. And my view is their intention is to kill or expel the natives. Where? Either Egypt, which is showing resistance even over the Philadelphia corridor, or Jordan. And obviously they're facing very stiff resistance. According to McGregor, the military expert, he slipped 5,000 Israeli soldiers dead and 100,000 either suffering from trauma or serious limbs, they've lost limbs, etc. So that they are suffering. So in terms of the resistance, the second alternative is if the Israelis cannot kill or expel, they will want to de-radicalize or demilitarize the whole area. By that I mean the Palestinians. So that's what's going on. However, Netanyahu, Hitler 2.0, as we refer to Netanyahu, isn't just the problem. You'll say, what do I mean by that? Well, it's quite clear he's got extremists in power with him. The Ben Gavirs, Smotrichs, and God knows many others. The point I'm trying to make is that he wants a bigger war. Whether you believe in Malahama or Armageddon is a eschatological perspective. However, in terms of what he is doing, it's quite clear he is not interested in a ceasefire. That's quite clear.
I think one of the most fascinating recent takes on all of this was just looking at the actual words as I read them out earlier on, actually, from this guy Maimonides. I'll repeat them again, because this is the sort of thing I think is so important to understand what is going on inside the far right bloc in Israel, is that they have this kind of twisted version of Judaism, very much like the twisted version of Islam that ISIS had. But this is, of course, the same in Christianity. So you've got these Christian Zionist swivel-eyed types that believe that all this is God's work, all this massacre of Palestinians. The Messianic King will arise in the future and restore the Davidic kingdom to its former state and original sovereignty. He will build the temple and gather the dispersed of Israel. All the laws will be reinstituted in his days as they had been aforetimes. Sacrifices will be offered, and the sabbatical years and jubilee years will be observed fully as ordained by the Torah. Published in 1180, that was Maimonides' Mishnah, Law of Kings, chapter 11, verse 1. So this is basically, this is part of the Torah, I imagine, but it's not, not the Torah, the Talmud, the Torah being the Jewish law. This is the various scribblings written by rabbis over the centuries. And by the way, I'm going to try something here. If you can find out where what the actual address here is of the studio. If you want to send a stamped addressed envelope in, I mean, this is the sort of thing you used to get in the 1960s on the TV. Send in a stamped addressed envelope, because I've got quite an interesting little, if you've never seen it before, I think it's probably on the Bilderberg website if you want to print it out. But I will post you a copy of this Revelation study, which I did a few years ago, which looks at various verses in the book of Revelation and how they could or should or maybe being played out today. I find it just amazing that we don't have a kind of devoted TV channel looking at the way that all of these apparent prophecies seem to be being fulfilled right now in front of our eyes, if only we can see it. I suppose there's quite a lot of effort to try and poo-poo these ideas. But I will, before the end of the program, I'll read out the address here. If you want to send a stamped addressed envelope with probably, it's probably best, actually just an ordinary sort of half of an A4, what's it, an A5 envelope, if you send one of those in, then I'll just post you back a copy of the Revelation study. But before we go, we're going to have a bit of fun with Halloween. I say fun because I'm quite convinced that there is this kind of satanic nature to all of this. So we've said goodbye to Martin. He doesn't like that sort of thing. And let's have a listen now to a lady called Doreen Irving. She was very kind of well known in the 1970s and 1980s. And Doreen had been a high priestess of witchcraft, as she explains. So we're going to hear two clips from her. One is an excerpt from a documentary, Devil Worship and the Rise of Satanism, that was made in 1989. But that was after she did her talk which was nearly 2 hours. Anyway, let's have a listen now to this excerpt from this documentary from 1989 called Devil Worship, The Rise of Satanism. Yeah, so this clip coming up from the Devil Worship film from the 1980s. Just to let you know, some pretty horrific stuff, so no kids listening to this, please.
For some of these young people, the fixation on violence, evil and death leads them to commit abominable crimes, including suicide and human sacrifice. Joseph Beeson, 18, and Edward Bennett, 19, both raised in Mormon homes, drew blood from their own veins and mutilated animals in satanic rituals. But that wasn't enough, so they eventually killed 18-year-old Michelle Moore. Sean Sellers, 17, the youngest death row inmate in Oklahoma, brutally murdered his mother and stepfather because they tried to prevent his satanic rituals. Scott Waterhouse, 17, tortured and killed a 12-year-old girl in a grisly satanic slaughter. Pete Rowland, 17, formed a satanic cult with three other boys. After sacrificing a cat, they turned on Steve Newbury, the fourth member of their group, and beat him to death with baseball bats while chanting, "A sacrifice for Satan." Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, was convicted of 13 murders and 30 other felonies. During the summer of 1985, he beat, strangled, raped, sodomized, shot, and slashed his victims in a rampage of sadistic satanic slayings. In the spring of 89, the dead bodies of 13 victims, one of whom was only 16 years old, were found mutilated and buried in a common grave near the American-Mexican border in Matamoros. This satanic drug-smuggling cult believed that sacrificing humans in bizarre rituals would give them magical protection. The victims had been dealt blows with a hammer, and some suffered horrible mutilations, including the removal of brains, hearts, and other organs that were then boiled in blood.
So that's a clip from a rather nasty film, but it's fascinating nevertheless. Devil Worship, The Rise of Satanism. And I should say that these give you a bit of a warning and advisory before these, because there's some pretty horrific things discussed in these. Not really stuff for children at all, is it? The point there, I suppose, is that you've got a criminal organisation which is running drugs, but then you've also got these sacrifices taking place and people being convinced that the sacrifice has made sure that the people are protected. Well, actually, surely there are government agencies, there are policing agencies, there are the FBI, etc., that might actually simply be influenced not to do any prosecutions, and there might be nothing magic about the fact that they've managed to get away with it at all. But the idea is to use blood, it seems, particularly human blood, in some of these rituals. Anyway, that was actually not the right clip from Doreen Irving. That was just a, although Doreen Irving is in that, and maybe we'll play that one next week, so wrapping around either side of Halloween. The point here is that Halloween is quite an important date in the calendar, and it has certain ramifications with modern day witchcraft. So let's have a quick look at what exactly it means. Witches celebrate Halloween as Samhain Eve, which is a major festival in the Wiccan calendar. Samhain is a Gaelic festival that marks the end of the harvest and the beginning of winter. Equinox, I guess. It's a time to remember those who've passed away and to celebrate the death of summer and the birth of winter. Well, maybe. But remember, of course, that witchcraft includes blood-curdling blood oaths that people swear to the secrecy of witchcraft on pain of death. So it's not some sort of game, although they try to paint it like that. Halloween has its origins in ancient Celtic pagan ceremonies. The Celts believed that the boundaries between the worlds of the living and the dead became blurred on the night before the new year. The people were afraid of what the evil spirits or the spirits of the dead might do if they visited the living. So this goes back a long, long way, I would say, right the way back to the Canaanites, as people like David Livingston have pointed out. And it's not just us. What about Margaret Murray, the witch cult in Western Europe? She was a very prolific writer in the 1930s and then also in the 1950s, pointing out that this cult has been going on for a very, very long time. time. So we'll wind up tonight with this clip from Doreen Irving herself giving her testimony back in 1986. And this was only relatively recently, in the last couple of years, uploaded to YouTube. And I'll put a link up to it on our show page. The full thing is absolutely fascinating, nearly 2 hours long. And here she describes when she was a Bristol prostitute, how she was blindfolded and given her wish of being taken to a satanic temple.
And I got to the Satanist temple that night, and they took off the blindfold, and I was surprised, to say the least, that I was at the back of about 400 people. And they didn't have comfortable seats to sit in. When they worshipped the devil, they stood for hours. No seats in the Satanist temple, only one. Everybody prostrated themselves on the ground and worshipped the devil. Effigies of Satan hung round the wall, half man, half beast, cloven from hooves and horns. At the front, there was a real altar, and one throne-like seat, beautifully carved, with snakes and dragons and flames of fire. And around the robed and hooded figure that sat on the throne-like seat were 13 priests and priestesses of the highest, the most ancient order of Satanism in the entire world. Their rites, their rituals, their evil writings and their evil books and the evil temples date back centuries. You see, witchcraft, Satanism, occult practices is not new. It was with us long, long before the flood. And that's why God warns about in the Bible. And he says, do not have anything to do with it. Deuteronomy 18 and other parts of the scripture, God forbids all occult practices. Why? Because there's a cruel, forbidding God? No. It's because he's a kind and loving God. And he only wants the best for the creation that he made. And so in love he said, thou shalt not do these things. It's not new. People think it's new because we see it increasing around us every day. More and more people are getting intrigued and getting involved in occult practices, and it's springing up more and more because we are living in the last days today, and Jesus said these things will happen before we return. Wickedness will increase, and we don't have to look very far, do we, to see wickedness increasing. We only have to turn on the TV, and we only have to listen to the radio, we only have to open the papers, and we read sickening accounts of how low man has sunk. Accounts of rape and murder and child abuse, pornography. These things will increase. But thank God, we as Christians know that the coming of the Lord draws nigh. We have this hope. Christ is coming very soon. Meanwhile, the devil is very, very busy. And I learned all there was to know about the Satanist order. I learned all the rules, there's just a few. You must not read the Bible for your own edification. In fact, all religious books, Bibles, prayer books, all religious books would be brought into the temple and burned. And I personally have burned Bible after Bible in the white hot flames in the Satanist temple. Two huge torches crossed themselves at the Satanist altar, high altar. And I burned Bibles in these huge torches until they disintegrated into flames, into ashes, and my hands remained in the flames unburned. That shows you how real Satan is, doesn't it? Doesn't it show you something far more important than that? Doesn't it show you how Satan hates God's word? All the more reason then that we should read God's word and believe God's word and act upon his word. They have their own Satanist book in the Satanist temple. And I was able to learn it from cover to cover by heart, and it's about 6 times thicker than the average Holy Bible. Another rule is no one must be irreverent in the Satanist temple. No one was late for a Satanist meeting. If you were late or irreverent at all or broke the rule, you were stripped and strapped to the whipping post and you were whipped. Nobody would dream of being late or irreverent in a Satanist temple. In fact, people were early and dedicated all the temple and all the objects in the temple. You know, when I first became a Christian in 1964, and they started to go into the Christian churches. You know, I was utterly appalled at what I saw. People coming in, you know, any old, dressed any old how, any old time, treating their hymn books and the Bibles like they were yesterday's newspapers, going in and out of the meeting, banging the door. It will never be allowed in the Satanist temple, and there they're worshipping the devil. Now, I'm not suggesting that we creep about God's house in fear because we serve a God of love. But I'm suggesting that we treat God's house with reverence and respect. Because Jesus said, God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. So there was no disrespect in the Satanist temple. When I learned all the rules, I was ready to become a fully fledged Satanist. Only the high priests and priestesses were there because you couldn't get all the Satanists into one temple. The biggest temple was at Brighton, and it held 700 people. And you couldn't get all the Satanists in there. So only the most important people were there, initiations. The evil ceremony began, the great wail to the devil, the great god of darkness, death and mystery, Lucifer, as we called him. And the air was heavy with evil. They went out, two of the high priests went out behind the black drape and brought in alive a white cockerel, the symbol of denial, which just means something for you who know your Bible. Remember when Peter denied the Lord, the cockerel. Well, for the Satanists, the cockerel is a symbol of denial. And they deny anything that's good and right. And they wrung its neck and they slit its throat and they caught the blood in one of the silver cups from the high altar. And they took a knife and they stirred the blood. My arm was cut and my blood was mixed with that of the white cockerel. And I had to drink that blood. And I had to put my finger in the blood and sign myself over to Satan with my own blood on a real parchment, not a scrap of paper, a real parchment, and it was stamped with the real seal of Satanism. This was regarded as a marriage to Satan, and I became Satan's bride. I had so much power as a witch and as a Satanist that I became the queen of black witches. I could make myself invisible. I even made a whole coven of witches invisible one night. I was able to elevate. I was able to make things move. I was able to kill birds in flight when they were let loose from the cage. This was done in demonstration of power in front of other Satanists. I saw Satan. I wasn't the only one who saw him. Oh, what does he look like, people say? Well, let me tell you, he can take on any appearance he wants to. And it's true what the Bible says. He comes as an angel of light to deceive many. So I know that Satan is real. I know how evil it all is. And I have this evil power and such powers of which my name was put down with others to compete for the title of the Queen of Black Witches of Europe. Not England, Europe.
So that was Doreen Irving. I'll put a full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Her testimony is nearly 2 hours long, and it's kind of reappeared after having disappeared. Although there were only a few clips of very, very bad sound, even worse than that sound quality, up online. So later tonight at thisweek.org.uk. So, Mr. Ian Hislop, all your denials of child ritual abuse and private eye, you can see what that's all about, because he's actually covering up for this sort of stuff, providing cover for them. So she says she was the queen of black witches for a while, but then she had a big change of heart and turned back to Christ. Amazing. Hallelujah. So Canaanite rituals, that's what we're really talking about, still going on in Britain today, apparently. So if you would like my revelation guide, just send a stamped addressed envelope to Blenheim Court, the studio, Blenheim Street, Bristol, BS5ONS. The Office of National Statistics, nice and easy to remember, only it's a zero rather than O. BS5ONS. O-N-S. I'll pop you a copy of that Revelation Guide back in a moment. I do sell on eBay these Bible studies, which have started going like hotcakes over the last few months for some reason. I wonder why that is. So there you go. That's Doreen Irving. I'll have a little bit more from her next week, actually. Much better sound quality next week. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Thanks also very much to Tony Greenstein and to John Shipton, Julian Assange's dad, and also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story clips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story clips, links and comment page, and our email addresses. If you can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. If you can afford it too, you can donate. And what I will do is I'll repeat now PayPal address for Rowan. So that is paypal.me, paypal.me/rasmy, RASMY 1998. So RASMY 1998, PayPal is her address in Northern Gaza, if you wanted to donate to them. But you can to us too at via thisweek.org.uk via the page there. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. Another thing is my paperbacks, if you get the Siege of Heaven reader paperback, that's Secret Government Anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana Assassination. That's cost £20 on eBay, an actual real book. It's got the Revelation Guide in there, although the one I pop out in the post, that is much more up to date. Anyway, this show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 5 and 11 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream and over Sunday breakfast at camberleysradioquk.com. Do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the Eastone Studios in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. A few hiccups with Google, maybe appearing on Amazon, but if you want to get hold of the app, best thing to do is simply go to the actual show page itself, thisweek.org.uk, near the top, near the big green button. There's a link to download the app there. Because Google, it's not on there anymore, Google Play, and I think it's probably off Aurora, sadly, for the time being. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know. I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do remember the clocks go back on Saturday night. And do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5 p.m. God bless. And don't let the synagogue of Satan or those satanic banksters get you down.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain.
like I see through the water that runs down my drain. He fastened all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. For threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know to talk out of turn? You might say that I'm young. You might say I'm unlearned. But there's the one thing I know. I'm younger than you. Even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die and your death will come soon. I follow your casket by the pale afternoon. I watch while you're lowered down to your deathbed. And I stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead.
Bomb is the gore in America. They be wheeling and dealing and robbing and stealing. They would do it to the mothers too. They have spread the filthy notion all across the ocean. Now half the world believe them too. Money is the gold here in America. 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 You know it's true.
You might wake up some morning to the sound of something moving past your window in the wind. And if you're quick enough to rise, you'll catch the fleeting glimpse of someone's fading shadow. Out on the new horizon, you may see the floating motion of a distant pair of wings. And if the sleep has left your ears, you might hear footsteps running through an open meadow. Don't be concerned, it will not harm you. It's only me pursuing something I'm not sure of. Across my dreams, with nets of wonder, I chase the bright elusive butterfly of love. You might have heard my footsteps echo softly through the distance in the canyons of your mind. I might have even called your name as I ran searching after something to believe in. You might have seen me running through the long abandoned ruins of someone I used to be. If you remember something there that glided past you, followed close by heavy breathing. Don't be concerned, it will not harm you. It's only me pursuing something I'm not sure of. Across my dreams, with nets of wonder, I chased a bright elusive butterfly of love. Across my dreams, with nets of wonder, I chased a bright elusive butterfly of love.